Alright, so we stopped last week at the end of Article 5. There are 12 articles in the B101. 12 is kind of like a fill in the blank, so we really have to get through 6 through 11, and we'll be able to get that covered definitely in today's class period. So if you remember, we're going to start with 6, as I said. You remember way back when we were talking about the initial information, and we talked about what the architect, the owner has to have a budget, the architect provides estimates. They all tie to this thing called cost of the work. Cost of the work is going to be one of those, again, defined terms that you guys are going to hear about and use throughout your entire career. Cost of the work is in every construction contract owner-contractor. It's in every owner-architect agreement because it's how much the project is going to cost. Money is, you know, the ultimate driver of all these things. And so we already showed you Articles 6.1 and 6.3. We're going to go over those again so you can understand that specifically. And it's important to kind of understand a little bit of the distinction between the cost of the work as the contract looks at it versus the owner's perspective of the cost of the project with a capital P. So if you think about when an owner goes to their board, or if it's not a corporation, it's just a homeowner or whatever, they got a budget. I can spend X dollars for the building of my house. Now that may include, in the owner's mind, I got to hire an architect. I got to purchase the land. I have to get insurance on the land while the project is being done. I have to make sure that the utility lines are coming in because the contractor needs power. And you can do power in two different ways. While the construction is going, the contractor can bring its own generator and charge you for all the fuel and oil and gas and everything else that they have on site. Or they can tap into your electrical thing. So there's all these things that happen that the owner has to pay for that is not the cost of the work. It's outside of that. And so that is the project budget. But for these contracts, the cost of the work is the budget that we're working for, is how much the project is going to be, the actual construction. So it says, should be the total cost to the owner to construct all the elements of the project with a capital B, designed or specified by the architect. So you guys are the drivers of the cost of the work, and that's why we have these in Article 3 at the end of SD, DD, and CD. Here's my estimate, I'm still within your budget. And the owner's going to look to you, again, many architectural firms are kind of removing themselves, especially as the projects are larger, from being estimators, or they have their own estimating branch, and that's an additional service that you can, or supplemental service you can pay for. But you're still the one that understands how much things cost. I mean, they kind of look to you in the beginning. So even if you are an architectural firm that says, we do not do estimating, and we don't have an estimating branch, so you can bring in your own outside estimator, you still got to have to know how much things cost. And there's plenty of resources and so forth and so on when you do that. But it's driven by you, designed or specified by the architect. Now, the second part there, it says, and shall include the contractor's general conditions, cost, overhead, and profit. So just as a general thought process, general conditions are, so I'm a contractor, I'm the general contractor, I come on site, I'm going to be there for 16 months to build this strip mall or whatever it is. I got to have an office. So I have a trailer. So job site trailer is part of the general conditions. Well, I also have to have, you know, a phone there. I got to have my cell phones. I got to have a copy machine. I got to pay for cost to get the documents reproduced. There's a bunch of outside costs that they must use to make sure they can facilitate the construction of the building, but they're not wood and sticks and stones and steel and everything else. Those are what's called the contractor's general conditions. General condition costs. That, and then there's overhead and profit. So they split it up into two, general condition costs and overhead and profit are kind of also kind of linked together. Overhead and profit is, well, profit, we all know the contractor has to make money, so there's a certain percentage built into that. But overhead is, even though they have a trailer that they're renting at the project site, and that's a general condition cost, and they have their insurance, and that falls into some other cost or what have you, they may also have their home office, where their home office is keeping records, and they have people that are working there. So you may have like a project manager. So you have your superintendent and you have your workers in the field. But the project manager may only come in once a week because that project manager, she's on six other projects. So she's not living out of each one of these six other trailers, not living, but having her office. She's got an office back in the main office because they have their main brick and mortar office. And so that's their overhead. So you're going to have, and then there's paying for the lights and the stamps and whatever else it is. And so those two things, and the contractor, when they give you a bid, is going to give you a price. It's based on most often a percentage of the cost of the work. But that will be included. So it's all the stuff you guys do, what you designed, and the contractor's general conditions and overhead and profit. That's your cost of the work. And it includes here, this is the better, I like this part, the second part, even though it's not highlighted, because it says, hey, it's not the architect's fee, that's outside of the cost of the work, it's not the cost of the land, it's not about financing charges like the interest you have to pay on a loan. None of those factor into the cost of the work for the project, but all of these in this second sentence here that's not highlighted falls under the cost of the project to the owner. So the owner's going to have two different budgets. And what you want to do as an owner, a good owner, is actually not going to tell the general contractor what their second budget is. Because if the owner has, you know, maybe they have a really expensive architect, or maybe they the money they pay for land or whatever, the contractors want to kind of eat into that money. They want to get, they're always going to say, well, it's going to cost more money and cost more money. All projects, not all projects, but most projects come in with a higher price somewhere. A great project, if you can get a project that comes in within 5% of the original bid, you've done a great job in managing the project, and the architect's done a great job in getting the drawings done and everything else. But it's not uncommon 10 to 15% of scope creep and increases in costs. And you don't want the contractor to be eating into the owner's budget, which includes the second part, the owner's budget for the project. So they make a distinction here, and that's important just to remember throughout your career. You'll see this cost of the work, like I said, you'll see the exact same defined term in the A-10201 and pretty much any construction contract you guys will look at. So, 6.2, which we did not show, I showed you 6.1 and 6.3 in the earlier, last week. So the budget for the cost of the work is provided in the initial information, which we saw that, and may be adjusted throughout the project as required under sections 5.2, 6.4, and 6.5. So 5.2 was in the owner's obligations to provide additional information. So if you remember, Articles 1, 2 and 3 talked about what the contractors were supposed to do. Article 4 of the V101 was this additional and supplemental conditions. Article 5 was the owner's obligations. And 5.2 talked about how the owner could, if there are changes, increase the cost of the project, or could decrease the cost of the project if they remove scope. And then it talks about under 6.4 and 6.5, which we'll get to shortly, the process by which you increase or subsequently potentially decrease the value of the cost, to decrease the project, which would reduce the cost of the work because the owner's budget is going down. So, what it talks about here also says is, if you remember, the initial information, the whole term initial is because you only know a little bit when you're starting out on a project. It's just a preliminary estimate of the cost of the work, and it's going to be updated estimates. Those are what the architect is doing. It's prepared by the architect, and they represent the architect's judgment as a design professional. And remember, the design professional concept comes in the standard of care. Architects, while they have knowledge of cost estimating, this contract does not put a higher level of saying you must be excellent at a cost estimator. In fact, unless the architect is going to represent and say we have a separate cost estimating branch, or if you go out and hire your cost estimator, these are all going to be kind of close to numbers. That's why they call it an estimate as opposed to a budget. And if there is a bust of the budget, if the numbers are off or whatever, there's going to be some wiggle room. And I'll show you when we get into Article 6.4 of what you can do as an architect to protect yourself, or as an owner can do to protect itself, to make sure that we don't have big swings in what the difference is between the architect's estimate and what the bids come in by the contractor. So, but most of the time, the owner's still going to be, even though you're going to say, hey, I'm just not an estimator, you should get somebody else, the owner's still going to look to you and say, but I got to rely on you, you're the professional. So there is some pressure on it, and that's why a lot of architectural firms step back from that, because they don't want to have liability. As much as there is some protection in this, represent the architect's judgment, not guarantee, there's protection for you guys in there. Like I said, some architecture firms want to stay away from that potential risk. And then the last sentence is much further kind of giving the architect a break. It says, the architect cannot and does not warrant or represent that the bids or the negotiated prices will not vary from the owner's budget for the cost of the work, or from any estimate of the cost of work or valuation prepared or agreed to by the architect. So that's the kind of, again, a get-out-of-jail-free card. Look, we are not guaranteeing anything. We are not warranting anything. So even if I do help you with an estimate, I can't promise you that it's going to be exactly right. The better architects are better at hitting their numbers. The better architects are, once the project gets going, even whatever those numbers are, they work to keep the contractor from getting too far afield and bringing in projects on time and on budget. So obviously at the end of the day, on time and on budget is the most important thing for the owner. And so good architects are good at that and their skill set. I will tell you this, and this is something all of you guys should think about when you're out there and working. For virtually any project that I do that gets into the eight figures, and maybe it's mid eight figures, like, you know, a $10 million project, I might not say you should bring in an owner's rep, but it's right around there. But when you get to 20, 30, 50, 100 million, what I say is to the owner, I say hire your contractor, hire your architect, and then hire a third person that is only on your side as a separate owner's representative. You're going to have your own person as that. Remember I talked about the single point responsibility, somebody from the company that they talk to that is the agent and the voice of the contract language? That's somebody from the company, the owner. But you hire a separate entity, and that separate entity, they are training professionals in both construction and cost. And so what they do is they're a watchdog over the contractor, and they're a watchdog over the architect. And they make sure that these two, when they squabble or when things are going on, that we keep them in line. And so that's something, and a lot of owners don't understand this. So I'll give you an example of one of my clients. They were building a nine-figure facility. It was somewhere between $200 and $300 million. And I said, we need to bring in an owner's rep. No, we've done this before. They built similar facilities in other places both in the country and overseas. And I'm like, I understand that. I know you've done this before. I'm just telling you, you need to bring this company in. So we started interviewing companies. And the price tag was between $1.5 million to $2 million per year for this owner's rep to be on a three-year project. So we're looking at anywhere between $4 and $6 million, or five and whatever that is, for this single entity that's going to be sitting out here simply as a back checker. And I kept saying, look, and we brought them in on a trial basis just during the process when the bids were being handled. The company, my client, who I have a great relationship now, but they were always fighting me, and I'm like, look, I don't have any skin in the game of who you're going to bring in. Like, I can give you a bunch of names, but I'm not getting a cut from that. I'm just telling you, spend the $4 to $6 million on these people. They'll save you a ton of money. They saved them about $30 million on the project. So that $4 or $5 million they ended up paying these guys made money for them in spades, because they saved a whole bunch of overruns. A lot of owners aren't really, they don't want to hear that. Like, why? I got the architect. They're going to help me. I got the contractor. They're my best buddy and everything else. So I'm telling you guys this because your firm may be just the designer, and an owner may bring somebody in as an owner's rep. They're not your enemy. They're going to work with you to keep everything, and they're probably going to work tighter with you to make sure the contractor stays in line. But if you're at a firm that has, because some firms, like I say, have cost estimating groups, some architecture firms also have their own separate owner's rep group, and they kind of sit apart. That's something that, again, if you're working on these large-scale projects, it's just helpful. Because at the end of the day, the owner is the one you want to make happy. And so, even though on this one project where we brought this company in, there was problems with both the contractor and the architect, because it happens. Because the owner's rep did such a good job in managing it and saving so much money, the problems that occurred were much more minor. And as a result, my client is looking to use the same architect and the same contractor for their next project. Had that owner's rep not been there, they may have had to go and start from the beginning. So there's a lot of benefits of repeat business and everything else about bringing somebody in. None of that, this whole discussion about owner's rep, is not going to be in the test. This is just me adding some of my own flavor of what's really good for a project when you get into the high dollar figures. So this is kind of a side, but think about it. It's not in here. In this instance, you guys, the architect's providing an estimate, and the second sentence that's highlighted in this paragraph is your protection. Question? That's a great question. What are the professions? Well, some of them, it's interesting because I've worked with all types. There's some of them are engineers, some of them are architects, some of them are accountants, some of them work for construction firms, and they work on the business side of the construction firms. So, like, some of the biggest companies you'll hear about, like Jones Lang LaSalle. I don't know if anybody heard of Jones Lang LaSalle. That's an owner's rep company, or I'm trying to remember some of the other ones. So, they're just people. A lot of people that I've had, they're like, my dad was a contractor, and so I liked the construction industry, but I didn't want to go out and be the one in the cold and swing the hammer, so I went to this. So there's a whole different mix, and that's actually, I think, that may be one of the reasons why they're good at what they do. There was a guy that that I worked with, and I had met him personally through a friend of mine. He was a stockbroker in Australia. And he moved to the States, and then he went in and he had his, he knew numbers. So he went in and started working for one of these larger owners, rep firms. So it's a whole mix of people, but they're really good at what they do. They at the end of the day, they're about budget, schedule, and then overseeing the flow of paperwork, because there's so much paperwork on construction. So. Sure. That's another great question. So some architecture firms will not have their own in-house estimator, but they will provide the services, and so what they'll do is they'll hire an estimator, like they're going to hire an electrical engineer or mechanical engineer. And so if you remember back in the initial information, there was, you know, you named the identity, the architects are going to name the structural engineer, the mechanical engineer, and the electrical engineer, and then they'll say other consultants. They might put Mike Canahan Estimating Services, Inc., or whoever it is. And then they can obviously negotiate with the owner and say, we can give you a basic estimate, but if you want a more brief, detailed breakdown estimate, we're going to hire this other estimating service, and that'll be an upcharge to you. We'll get our 10% cut because we get a percentage of their work, so they make a little bit of money off of that. And then they know that the numbers are good. And there are great cost estimators out there. I work with a number of, like, what'll happen for me on lawsuits is I will go to cost estimators, and in their group, they'll have the people that work on the projects all the time, and they'll have a subgroup of people that testify as experts. So they're cost estimators. They've been doing cost estimating for years and years and years, but now they've added to their well of other stuff. So then with my project, let's say I'm representing an owner, the project's over budget, I say the contractor's done a bad job, and he's like, well, the costs were these and this and that. I'll bring in a cost estimator. They'll go through every record, break everything down, and show where the waste is, and then they'll testify why those problems came up. So, did you have a question back there or no? You did or did not? Okay, good. All right. So, 6.3, we saw before, but I'm going to bring it up just one more time. This is, we saw last week. It says, in preparing the estimates for the cost of the work, the architect shall be permitted to include contingencies, like a wiggle room. That's the concept of the word contingency. There's stuff out there that I'm not quite sure, so I'm going to put in extra money into my estimate for the contingency. So the design, bidding, price escalation, I mean, if you think about it, as things happen, so like when Hurricane Katrina, which was a while ago, but and maybe even most recent hurricanes, because I haven't tracked the ones that came in the last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever they were. But for rebuilding all the stuff that got destroyed, there was a lack of supply of drywall. There was no drywall available because everybody's rebuilding. And it'll be interesting to see what happens like with the LA fires when they go out there and all the houses that were ripped down. So prices of materials go up because there's just not enough availability because this tragic occurrence happened all at one time and people have to start rebuilding. So there's price escalations that come in. Bidding, maybe what's going on in the economy, there's a bidding war and things go up. So an architect in its estimate is allowed to include that. So they can put some wiggle room, and that's a good cue for you guys if you are doing estimating or if your company's doing estimating. And then you can determine what materials, equipment, component systems, et cetera, to be included in the contract documents. You'll make adjustments in the program and the scope during the course of the project. When you're talking to the owner's going to say, I have more money, or I have less money, or this is the only money I have, but some reason your estimates keep coming in too high. So the architect and your job, because you speak the language, you read the drawings, you understand the owners, by and large, are unsophisticated. It's up to you to counsel them, to guide them. Your scope of work needs to be brought back in order to meet these costs. We can do some value engineering, we can do some of this, we can do some of that, but you may not be able to afford what you're looking for. You know, your eyes are too big for your belly was a saying that my parents used to always say to me growing up and stuff like that. So, now, those are reasonable adjustments to the project scope. You're not going to be like, oh, let's go way high or way low. You want to still work within the framework of what the owner is, but it's up to you to communicate. Also, in the cost of this parts talk about include alternate bids may be necessary to adjust the estimated cost of the work to meet the owner's budget. So what you might say is the owner's like, but I really want it to be designed this way. I want you to design it. Let's go out and test the field. Let's see what it is. The architect's like, okay, we will do that. But we think you might want to have an alternate design, some alternate responses. And when you go out to bid, you get two bids back. One is for your grand prize, the owner's really what they really, really want, and the other may be a pared down or scaled down. That alternate could be also the opposite, too. Like, what'll happen is when you get a bid, you'll see that the architect will design something and they'll use a certain type of brick for the house. The owner maybe wanted to use limestone, which is much more expensive, as opposed to just normal brick. So they'll say, they'll have in the request for proposal, which is a big document that goes out that has all the drawings and information for the project, there'll be a section that says alternates. And you ask the contractor on a line-by-line basis, if we did the house not in brick, but if we did it in limestone, how much would that be an increase? And then that becomes kind of a shopping list for the owner. The owner may have some more room in their own budget, because they didn't tell the architect everything, and so they can say, oh, I'll take this alternate. Maybe I'm going to go use a different type of window system. Maybe I have an alternate for solar panels on the roof. There's a whole host of things. As you're talking with your architect, the owner talking with the architect about what this project really means, that can be included in these alternates. And that allows, when it goes out to bid, that you get a couple bids back from each contractor, and you can see, will that work? Maybe even what happens, and I've had this, where you have, I did a lot of work for Navy Pier, and so I did a number of projects with them. Navy Pier has a board, it's a public entity, it's a 501c3 charitable organization, so they have wiggle room, but they get their money from bonds from the state. The state of Illinois gets some bonds, they have those bonds to draw from, they put together their budgets and everything else. But the people that sit on the board, sometimes they have these grandiose ideas of what things are supposed to look like. And so we would go out to bid for projects with Navy Pier where we would have the basic design and then we'd have these kind of pie-in-the-sky stuff. And then we present it to the board and we'd say, if you really want this, we can do this, but your budget has to increase. And then the board would go back and look to see what funds were available through the bonds and see if they could do that. So there's all different ways. It's not just simply a one stop. You're just talking to the owner's rep and saying, I got $10 million. Sometimes the owner's rep can go back and talk to the people behind the scenes and get a little bit more money, depending on what these alternates look like. So, and then also down here, architect's estimate across the work shall be based on current area, volumes, similar concepts, blah, blah, blah. If the owner requests detailed cost estimating and services, the architect shall provide such as additional services under Article 4. So here's a sentence where this, I haven't gone back and looked at the history, but I am 98% sure that this sentence, this last sentence, was brought in as what happened with litigation moved along over the years. This document's a living, breathing document. As I said, every 10 years they revamp it, they add sentences, they take some away, change paragraphs. My guess is what happened in this is there was enough times when the architect would give the owner some estimates, and then the pricing came back wrong, and the owner's like, well, why didn't you give me this detailed breakdown? And the architect says, that's not my job under basic services. I'm just to give you a general estimate. If you want me to do detailed estimates, it's going to cost more because that takes more man hours. And then the owner would fight with him and say, no, blah, blah, blah. So this, my guess, is this last sentence here, is to say, hey, even if we are doing estimating services, it's not detailed. If you want that, we're going to charge you more, which is fine. I mean, that's part of what you guys are doing. I mean, everybody's in business to make money. So I think that this is a great sentence for the architect. I think it clarifies for the owner. And it's a good marketing piece for you guys. So, questions on that? Whoops, I think I went twice. 6-4. So if you remember, right? Yes, 6-4. You remember in Article 3... one of the phases was bidding and negotiation. I went through it fairly quickly because I didn't want to get into the details of it and all, but there's either negotiated proposals or there's lowest responsible bid, so competitive bidding is what they call it, so competitive negotiation. But at some point in time, there's going to be this negotiation phase between the owner and the contractor, so this is referencing that. And it says here, like, you're going to give the drawings and an estimate to the owner. The owner sits on it for a while. Life changes. Costs could go up. You know, you never know what's going to happen. So this gives you another protection. And it says, if you haven't gone out basically to bid within 90 days of when the architect hands over the construction documents, then through no fault of the owner, the budget for the cost of the work must be adjusted to reflect changes in the general level of prices in the applicable construction market. And those can happen. So we were working on a project back in 2021, or 2020, actually it started in 2019, but it extended all the way through the work. Part of this project still actually has work ongoing. But the summer of 2021, the cost of just basic 2x4s went through the roof. Because one of the only things that was happening during COVID, as far as, or not the only thing, but what one of the strongest driving industries during COVID was the construction industry, because you could work outside. And while I had to write in protocols into all the construction contracts about health and safety and what would happen if there would be somebody that was tested positive and there was all these restrictions that we went through and et cetera, there was still lots of construction going on. That, and much more than had before. So that drove the price of lumber up. And what ended up happening was lumber went up so fast and so quickly that it became actually cheaper in some projects to use steel studs instead of wood studs. Steel studs, because for whatever reason, steel studs stayed consistent, but the price of wood, the price of lumber went up. And so, and that was within months. It wasn't within, like sometimes we actually had one project that I was working on. It was about a $2 million structure. And my contractor had to price the studs out on a week-by-week basis because they were just up and down and up and down and up and down. And we were pushing the architect. We're like, get us the design so we can lock this in so we can order the wood we need, the materials we need. We ended up going steel studs. And then we actually, because by that time, steel studs are starting to fluctuate, we had to choose between the size and the gauge. So there was these things. So this can happen. And this is important for you guys because... here's my estimate, whether it's detailed or not. You can't hold me to my numbers if the price is fluctuating. So you don't want to tag me for that. And then 6.5 says, if any time the architect estimates the cost of work exceeds the owner's budget, the architect shall make appropriate recommendations to the owner to adjust the project size, quality, or budget, and the owner shall cooperate with the architect. So this is that point where you may have to sit down and tell the owner, your cool building is going to be too expensive. So either you give me more money to work with, not literally, but your budget goes up, or we have to scale down. And so this is, again, another roadmap to the owner. That's your job to tell them that. And they won't be surprised by it. And if you do start telling them, they're like, wait, why are we coming this late in the game? And you've already given me a price after you give me the construction documents. You can say, look to 6.5. I have to do this. This is my responsibility. On the flip side, if you don't do this under 6.5, you may get tagged for it. Just because this protects you and tells the owner, I may bring something up, you still got to raise your hand. And if you fail to raise your hand, then there's some problems. And we'll talk about that in 6.6. So under 6.6, the owner's budget for the cost of the work at conclusion of the construction document phase, that's when you're finishing the drawings that they can use to build, is exceeded by the lowest bona fide bid or negotiated proposal, the owner shall, and there's a list of things that the owner can do here. I think it's just a one page, let me check here. Yeah. So these are the five things that the owner should do. Now, the simple statement here is, owner said, I got $1 million budget for my house. Architect designs it at the end of SD, it's at 850. At the end of DD, it's at 925. And at the end of CD, you've worked it through and you're at 900 even. You're $100,000 under the owner's budget. We're all good. You got rid of all the gold-plated faucets, whatever it is, blah, blah, blah. It goes out to bid and it's $1.1 million. It's above the owner's $1 million budget. You got a 1.1, you got a 1.3, and you got a 1.4. So you got bids, not every single one. So the lowest bona fide, so you only look at the 1.1, but it's still over the budget that the owner did, and it's still certainly over the estimates of the contract the architect gave. So what can happen is, I can increase my budget. That's an onus on the owner. 2, authorize a rebidding renegotiation within a reasonable time. Maybe we need to get some cheaper contractors. Maybe we need to kind of look at that. We're going to renegotiate. Terminate. In accordance with section 9.5. Well, that's pretty dramatic. But you can, because the owner has relied on you for those estimates all aligned, say you breached your contract, I'm firing you, architect. I will tell you, it would be crazy for any owner to fire an architect if they blew the budget by only a small margin. Because what happens then? Who owns the drawings? We'll talk about that in a second under Article 7. The architect. The architect takes them back and says, I get these drawings. You can't build your building. And then we have to start from the beginning. And then you got to hire a new architect. And then you got to pay that architect. And now you're 8 months, 10 months late or whatever it is. So it's like the worst thing in the world to terminate. But maybe it's been a really bad relationship between owner and contractor, or owner and architect, and so maybe it's. So this gives you the right that, hey, you promised me, even though you didn't warrant, you told me these estimates were good, and we blew the budget, you're fired. So that's something the owner can do. It's pretty dramatic. I don't recommend it. And if I was the architect and the owner came to me and said, I'm looking to fire you, you're like, let's see what we can do here. And In consultation with the architect, revise the project program scope or quality as required to reduce the cost of the work or any other mutual acceptable alternative. This one, 4, is an interesting one because who should pay for that? If the architect has to change its design, they're going to have to put more work into it. So should the owner pay the architect or should the architect pay for that additional work? That will often become a negotiation. And it depends on how far off you are. I want to check something really quick. So, that's 6.6.4, okay? So if we go to 6.7, it says if the owner chooses to proceed under 6.6.4, which is, hey, architect, we got to work together to revise the drawings, the architect, without additional compensation, 6.7 answers that question. Who pays for the redesign? shall modify the construction documents as necessary to comply with the owner's budget. The owner's like, it's been a million since day one. I've relied on you to keep it under a million since day one. Why are we at 1.2, 1.3, and 1.4? Doesn't make sense to me. I don't want to fire you, but we got to get this right. You got to redesign for free. I don't think it's an unfair request by the owner. The owner has been very clear and confident. And that's why architects don't like to take on this estimating responsibility, because then they're potentially put into a place for forced or losing money because they have to, they're forced to do redesign. Question back there.
So is this the estimate or the detailed estimate?
It doesn't matter, because the trigger, and let me go back to the paragraph so you can see it. Remember, the owner's always talked about its budget. The estimates that the architects are giving has that wiggle room. I'm doing it to the best of my job. I'm putting in contingencies for this and that. But the owner hears these numbers, and the reality is the owner hears a number and believes it, whether it's got all these red flags about it as it's an estimate. Because the owner doesn't know how to put these numbers together, so they're hearing it. And every time the architect says it's an estimate, it's still below the owner's million-dollar budget. And the owner only cares about the budget. It's got to be budget or below. And so if you look at the paragraph before, the trigger is the owner's budget is exceeded, not the estimate. So even if the estimate was $900,000 and it came in at $950,000, this isn't triggered because the budget was still $1 million. So it's only about the number of the owner. And that's why you have the previous sentence where we go back under 6.5, where you have an obligation to make recommendations. And if you fail to make these recommendations, if you feel that your 950 to that million may not have enough wiggle room, you got to tell them, look, we're close. We may need to pare these things back so we still hit your million-dollar budget. And if you fail to do that, or if your numbers are coming in at 1.1 yourself and now you're trying to do some scrubbing because you don't want to give bad news to the owner. Like, it's not easy to tell an owner, hey, you're not going to get this. It's tough. I mean, that's just human nature. I mean, it happens to me all the time. When I'm in a lawsuit and there's bad facts in the case, the hardest thing to do is tell my owner, because I mostly represent owners, is like, you're going to lose on this. I just need you to understand this is bad for us. Nobody wants to hear bad news, and lawyers get bad news all the time. And nobody wants me to pay me to deliver bad news, because I'm the one researching and investigating. And I'm like, here's my bill. Oh, by the way, we're going to lose. Like, that sucks. But you got to do that. And here, it's a little different for you guys because you're working all the time. But 6.5 puts you in the responsibility to keep the owner informed. And the owner can rely on it. So again, these provisions, as we look at it, 6.4, 6.5, and why is this switching? Oh, here we go. And 6.6 are about that communication that happens between the owner and the architect, and how we do that. And 6.6 here triggers off of the owner's budget, not your estimate. So when we get to this provision here, 6.7, it says, you guys, architects, you blew my budget. You have to redesign for free. So what do I do as an architect? And if, again, I don't think it's an unfair responsibility or unfair request by an owner. Look, I told you all the time, $1 million. Don't exceed it. So what do we do to protect the architect here? Because it could be literally, since the last sentence says the lowest bona fide bid exceeds the budget, it could be $1,000,001. The owner could go back to the architect, redesign. I want you to redesign. And use that to their benefit to kind of tweak and change and all this other stuff because they had, you know, somebody in the family said I wanted it differently, or the board said I wanted to change or whatever. So what does an architect do? What should an architect do? They should build in contingencies. They should make sure they're looking what's going on in the market. We've got the good language here in this contract. But sometimes what you're going to do is you're, as an architect, you're going to say, I'm going to do 6.7, or I'm sorry, probably best to go back to 6.6, the language to do it, because that's the one that triggers. So let me go back to that for you here, because I've done this for many architects. where it says it's exceeded by the lowest bona fide bid in excess of 5% or 8% or 10% of the owner's budget. So if it's $1 million and you put in a 10% kicker, you get up to $1.1 million. So my recommendation, it's not a niche, you're not going to be tested on it, but if you're sitting down thinking about good business practices, if you have an owner that you feel that they're really strong and stickler on pricing, and as we all know, prices change over the course of time and markets go up and down and everything else, well, you have put in as many of those wiggle room contingencies as you design. Add a 10% kicker here, or a 15% kicker here. Put down 15, and owners will be like, not a chance. Maybe we can negotiate it down. And you land at 8. And I'll tell you this, it works. One of my projects that I worked on, they came in they were adamant they were going to hit the number. Adamant. It was over and over and over and over and over again. And they came in, and we blew the budget. We were up by 14%, and it was a 12% number that we negotiated in the contract. And they didn't want to redesign for free. They said, yeah, we'll redesign. We told you this is going to be expensive, blah, 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 blah. And I got a call from my client, because I wasn't part of any of those discussions. That all happens in the bidding and the communication and everything else. And I got a call from my client, and they're like, our board is furious. What do we do? And I'm like, well, give me your numbers. And they told me the numbers. And I said, do you want me to write the letter, or do you want to write the letter? Because they are locked in at 12%, and we were at 14. And they had to redesign. And it was a simple thing, because it had been negotiated. It was clear. And it worked in benefit. In that case, it worked to the benefit of the owner. But if they had came in at 10% over the budget, and the number was 12, and the owner came back and said, shit, you're 10%, and this is like a $200 million project, so it wasn't cheap, it's $20 million. They're like, but I have a 12% wiggle room in here. We're still within my obligations of the contract. So ask for as much percentage as you can in this section here. It'll protect you from spending, your firm having to spend and work for free. And it gets more clarity and parameters for you and the owner. So, question back there. Well, see, and that's the point. Yeah, the question is, if you're only $1 over $1 million budget, I mean, that's like 0.001% or 0.0001%. I mean, it's nothing. Like, I could remove a doorknob or something. Like, simple, it'd be easy. But will an owner come back and say, I want you to start making all these tweaks, and is that fair and reasonable? And so you as the architect could say, I only have an obligation to adjust your scope and schedule based on 6.5 and 6.4 to get within the $1 million budget. I don't have an obligation to start doing all these wholesale changes. And if you're asking me to do these, I'm going to charge you extra for that. And here's a section that we got there. Excuse me, in Article 11 that shows me where I can charge. So there's going to be a push and pull you on that. It's an owner would be crazy to do that. I mean, again, if an owner came to me and said, "Hey, we're $10,000 over budget," I'd be like, "Don't go back and fight over this." I said, "The cost for me to run the numbers, to write the letter, to talk to their lawyer, to run some more numbers, to get everybody cranky, you're going to spend $10,000 to me, and everybody's going to be mad at each other before the marriage even starts." So sometimes you have these business discussions. That's what I have with my clients. But when we were on a $200 million project and we were 14% over budget and we had negotiated a 12%, I know it's really only talking about 2%, but that's still $2 million. So we were able to get it back, and when they redesigned, we came in at about 5% over budget. They took out $9 million of their project, which was great. The board was then happy. Their costs, they took out a couple big chunks, so it wasn't a lot of detailing redesign. They took out, they said, we, and there was good discussions with the owner, and that made for a good relationship too. So there are benefits from having, like, one of the best things about a contract, if you don't just stick it into the drawer after you sign it, the best thing about a contract is it continues to foster communication. Communication between an architect and an owner translates to the next project. Maybe it's the owner's next project, or the owner's friend's next project, or simply because you did such a good project for the owner, because lots of communication, you advertise on time and on budget, and the general public sees that. So I teach contracts, I draft contracts, and I constantly tell my clients, owner, contractor, architect, whomever I'm drafting for, I'm like, this is something that must remain living and breathing and not in your drawer. And people don't understand that because they feel that contracts are like fighting and lawyers and lots of words. But if you break it down, and that's what I try to do for you guys, if you break it down to just kind of what it means and use that as communication, it's the one of the best things for your business. Saving money, having good relationships, and making and getting the next project. That's what a good contract does for you. Okay, so that's the end of Article 6 on kind of cost of the work and how things do. Any questions? There'll be a few questions on cost of work. It's not going to be a ton, but there are going to be some, and so you want to pay attention to that. Article 7, I've talked about this half a dozen times throughout the semester, right? This is copyrights and licenses. Copyrights is something that is near and dear to my heart because when I first got out of law school, it was in the 90s, the SNLs crashed, and nobody was building. And so here I'm an architectural student that has a law degree that wanted to be a construction lawyer, and nobody was building anything. So I'm like, holy crap, what do I do? So I went to go work for a patent firm because I have my engineering background. So one of the things that I started diving into was copyrights, because copyright is part of the intellectual property world. I wrote patents for stuff. I wrote a patent for, I swear to God, this is not a joke. Patent drafting can be incredibly boring because you have to be very detailed in how you use the words, because that patent is kind of like your drawings and specifications as an architect. Someone can read that patent and then they can't build something that falls within the parameters of those very specific words. And you make up words. Like I had I worked with one of our clients was a dental company. They made dental instruments. And they had this box that opened up. And in the box had these two mousetrap arms that swung down and were tight on it. And what you did is it was a stainless steel box with a bunch of holes in it. And you put the dental instruments, the ones that scrapes and everything else. You put them in, the mousetrap arms hold those things down. You close the box up and you put it in this thing called the autoclave, and it cleans the instruments. Basically like a dental dishwasher. That's it. It's a box with a couple of mousetrap arms. You put your instruments in it. Now, I couldn't explain it that way, so I had to start using these words and everything, and I was a baby lawyer, straight out of law school, working for this engineering, for this patent firm, and I went to one of my bosses that was one of the gurus. He had written this 11-volume treatise on trade work dress and everything else. Like, he knew everything. So I go to him, like, Mr. Altman, what do I do for this? And, like, how do I describe these mousetrap arms? And he's like, well, explain to me what happens. And I'm like, he goes, how are they connected? I'm like, well, there's a hinge that goes back and forth. And he's like, well, where are they connected? And I'm like, well, they're connected to the side. He's like, well, how are those? Do they just flop in and out? And I'm like, well, no, they're fixed there. He's like, well, there's your answer. And I'm like, what? He's like, they're fixedly, hingedly attached to the sidewalls of the box. And I'm like, fixedly, hingedly? Those words don't exist. But that became my patent. So I enjoyed intellectual property, but was really bored, but I wanted to pay attention because of my undergraduate in architecture when I started looking at it. Just so happens that in 1990, they passed a new law, or updated the copyright law. Copyrights are actually an intellectual property in the Constitution, so they've been around since the very first hierarchy of our list, the intellectual property concept. You can own something that only is in your brain. You can't pick up a patent. You can't pick up a trademark or dress. It's just in your brain. I own that design. Well, I own that Nike swoosh, whatever that might be. So I started looking at copyrights, and in 1990 they passed the Architectural Works Copyright Act of 1990. It's a subset of the Copyright Act. And what was going on in the industry is that there had been a number of lawsuits dealing with principally, now there was a bunch of them and all different things, but principally dealing with large-scale homeowner development. Like people would be building subdivisions. Okay? So you go in, you see this brand new subdivision being built, and you're wanting to buy it, and they say, come to our office. You go to their like double wide trailer in the subdivision that's being built. They have pretty pictures up on the wall, and they have 6 different designs. They got the colonial, they got the Georgian, they got the capitalistic, whatever it might be, capital, what the different names of the different things. And so some may have grand columns with Ionic coils, and some may, all these different things. That's the style of the 5 homes you could buy for the subdivision. You can make some tweaks here and there, but basically everybody's going to have one of those 5. So what ended up happening was, is there was, and I represented a company called, and worked for them actually when I was studying architecture in the summer, a company called Pulte Homes. I don't know if you guys know Pulte Homes. Pulte Homes is one of the largest developers, subdivision developers in the world, in the country. And they're all over. And so I had done some work with Pulte. They weren't part of this lawsuit, but they told me what would happen. People, their competitors, because they were one of the better ones, the high end, the competitors would come in and they would take the brochure, which had the little floor plan on it, and they put the brochure over there, and they build the building. They weren't copying off it, they built something that looked like it. That was copyright infringement because they took the brochure and they got caught from that. So then they decided, okay, what do we need to do? What I'm going to do is I'm going to go look at a building that's already complete. I'm going to take pictures and I'm going to measure the actual building because I'm not using the drawings. And the only thing that copyrighted before the Architectural Works Copyright Act of 1990 was the drawings or the specifications, because it was a tangible reproduction of what that idea was. The building itself constructed was not a copyrightable piece. The Architectural Works Copyright Act changed that and said, even as constructed, that is the same as the drawing. That's copyright, you can't cheat. So there's these laws that came in. So that got me really interested in it. And what I realized is going through that and representing a few architects while I worked for this patent firm, and then I've represented a number of architects since I switched back over to just the straight construction lawyer, is that's kind of your lifeblood. That's your protection as an architect. Your copyright is something you don't want to give up. Now, some owners are going to be like the 800-pound gorilla, and they're going to make you give them the ownership of the drawings. What you really want to do is only give them a license, and we're going to talk about that in a second. You still want to own the copyright, the intellectual property, in your drawings. And what I say to every class every year is fight as hard as you can to keep that. That's your lifeblood. You know, you can take that same design and do it somewhere else. You can modify, you can do whatever you want. But if you sell the ownership, as opposed to the license, if you sell the ownership in that design, and you designed that really cool Georgian house, you can never use that in the design again because you don't own that copyright. You're infringing on what the owner of that copyright has, even though they didn't design it. You sold it to them. So that's just kind of an overview of why I think intellectual property and copyrights is really important for an architect. Question back there. Great question, and there's a paragraph in here, we'll talk about that. But yes, you can, and the purpose of the way this is written is to make sure that the license can be used, but it's limited in who can use it, so we'll get there. So let's talk about 7.1. The architect and owner warrant that in transmitting the instruments of service, remember that the instruments of service is your drawings, your axons, your specifications, your models, whatever, renderings, CAD, just stuff, anything, that's the instruments of service. The transmitting party is the copyright owner, the person that's handing it off, architect, of such information or has permission from the copyright owner to transmit such information for use on the project, not any project, the project with a capital B that we defined in the initial information section. That's why that initial information section is important, because it's just this project. Now it talks about the transmitting party is either the owner or has permission from the owner. I'm an architect. I design your floor plan. I've hired a mechanical engineer to do your plumbing and your HVAC. I've hired an electrical engineer to do your electrical work and your lighting figures, and I've done the structural engineer. All 3 of those consultants have their own copyright, and they have given you, the architect, a license to transmit that license to the owner to use to build the project. So that second half of the sentence, it says, I've got permission from my EE or my SE or my ME that I can use their drawings and their license to give to you, owner, to build your project. So that's what this sentence says. And you're representing, I own it, or I have permission to give it to you. And if there's a squabble between the architect and ME because the ME hasn't been paid for a while, the mechanical engineer, and the license hasn't been given, well, then that's a misrepresentation. And right there, the architect could be in breach because they're lying. So there's some things here, but that's what this says. Is I own it as the architect and you can use it, or I have permission to let you use it from the people that did it for me. Next paragraph. The architect and architect's consultants, civil engineer, mechanical engineer, whom all those are, and those, remember, are listed back up in the initial information as well, the consultants, shall be deemed the author and owners of their respectable instruments and services. So we all know from the get-go, from the basic language of this provision, the owner and everybody else knows that the owner isn't the owner. The people that created it own these copyrights of their own various instruments of service. That way there's no misunderstanding. And what I, as the architect, is going to do is I'm going to give you a license, which comes up in the next paragraph. Upon execution of the agreement, that's after we figured out the pricing and the terms and who's going to be responsible for what, and are you going to pay me on time, and what can happen if you don't, and everything else, architect grants to owner a non-exclusive license. Non-exclusive means you, owner, can use it, but you're not the only one that can use it. I can use it with 25 other owners. Non-exclusive license to use the architect instruments and services solely and exclusively for the purposes of constructing, using, maintaining, altering, and adding to the project. This project solely and exclusively, none other. Now, everybody's like constructing, that makes sense, we got to build it. But at the end of the project, you kind of give the owner the drawings because maybe a pump goes down, maybe we need to fix the windows, maybe there's some creakiness, so they can use it for maintenance. Altering, they can alter, they can do an addition. They don't have to call you back if they do an addition. So, for example, I talked about it a couple times. We did this little 100-square-foot addition in my house. I had the drawings. The drawings were actually transferred to me from the builder that built it, and he had already gotten the license from the architect. And we went to a new architect, and we gave her our drawings and said, we need to use this to, and you're allowed, because I had the right under the license, so you, my new architect, can alter it and add into the project. So that's like an addition or stuff like that. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean, and I had, there's a project, I can't remember what it was called. So I used to live at Lakeshore Drive and Addison. Right on there was like one block, one building in. You know, right on Lakeshore Drive, they have all those real tall high rises. So immediately north, there were two towers, and there were supposed to be actually, I think, four or six when it was originally designed. Two towers were built there. And there was a huge open area. It may be filled now, but it's literally right north of Addison, off of Lakeshore Drive. And the whole point was, is there was a problem. So they built these two, and the owner then didn't have enough money to continue to build the next two. And they were always going to redevelop and put, or continue the development and put up at least two more. I don't know if it was again two or six. Didn't do it when I was living there. And what I ended up ultimately learning was, is not only was there problems with the owners getting financing, but there was also squabble between the architect and the owner as to who owned the drawings, because it wasn't clarified in this. So they used the drawings for the two towers they built, but when they were going to build two more towers, they were not allowed because the license wasn't for that project. The initial project was two towers, not four. Had they had the contract written, said it was for four, there may have been some other clauses that would talk about, does the architect get called back in? Is there additional fees? There's lots of other ways you can do that. But that's why there were not two more, at least at the time, this is going back a number of years, two more mimic towers, even though I knew the developer wanted to continue with it. So, And then the other thing here, though, and this is interesting to get, because the architect is giving something to the owner, it says, provided the owner substantially performs its obligations, including prompt payment of all sums when due under this agreement. I'll give you that license, and you can use these drawings as much as you want, but you got to keep paying me. And when you don't pay me, that license doesn't work. So, to your question, can the architect and the owner use it? Well, it says right here, the license granted, architect, I grant you, owner, this license to permit the owner to authorize contractors, subcontractors, sub-subs, all these other people, even the owner's consultant, even that special architect that's going to design the kitchen, the super cool kitchen or whatever, to reproduce applicable portions of the instruments and services solely and exclusively performing their services. So the electrician's going to use the electrical drawings, the mechanical's going to use the mechanical drawings, and to the extent any of you guys have worked, when you're going to look at drawings, there's going to be an A set, that's the architecturals, there's an M set, that's the mechanicals, there's an E set, electrical, and an S set for structural. There may be some other stuff in there, but that's your common, you're going to see. And then the pages will be like A1, A2, A3, S1, S2, E3, 4, whatever they are. So that's going to be, and so when you go to the structural engineer, you don't give them the E drawings, you give them the SE drawings. So those are the ones that they work off of. They may have to look at all some for other interfaces, but generally that's what they're working on. They're applicable proportions. And then it goes on. This last sentence says, if the architect rightfully terminates this agreement for cause as provided by 9.4, which we'll get there, the license granted in this section 7.3 is terminated. If you, and 9.4 effectively says, and we'll get there, but one of the things is, if you breach this contract, including not paying me, license is gone. This provision is what I used with the reflected ceiling plan case. You didn't pay me, your license is revoked, it's black and white, I'm shutting down the project because you're in breach. That's what I used. So, it's a very powerful tool. Don't let it go. It's your livelihood. Now, owners all the time are going to be trying to get more from you. They're going to try to get, they're going to own it, they're going to try to pay for stuff, and they're trying to do this and that. Fight tooth and nail for it. Keep it. Because this is where you can protect yourself to get paid. And for your next project. And for this and that. Don't make it hostile. There's a student session, student center, and L stop down at IIT. I don't know if you guys know. It's kind of funky where the train kind of goes into the student section. That was done by a Danish, I think. Rem Koolhaas did that design. I did all the contracts for IIT on that, both the design contracts and the construction contracts. And IIT thinking, we're IIT and you're over there and blah, blah, blah. We're going to own this copyright so we can do what we want. Rem Koolhaas said, he said, not a chance. And we negotiated. I mean, that was like one of the biggest sticking points. IIT never got the ownership of that copyright. They got exclusive rights. We struck this non-part and they got exclusive rights. They're like, okay, you're not going to give it to us, but I don't want to see anything like this anywhere else. So we were able to negotiate an exclusivity. So sometimes the owner will say, all right, you keep your copyright, but I want it to just be mine. Nobody else is going to have this really cool entrance feature. And you'll get paid more for it. The architect gets paid for that. There was a pricing. I mean, we negotiated a bunch of stuff, but it included more money. So Rem owned the copyright because as a general business matter, he would never give it up. He didn't need to. He was Rem Koolhaas. And as a functional matter, it is IIT to kind of tout this cool structure. Nobody else could build one like that because they have an exclusive license. So there's all different legal ways to work this through. When I worked for McCormick Place, they did for the MPEA for all their stuff, when we went out for bids, every one of our RFPs, before any architect ever bid on the project, our RFP says the MPEA shall own the copyrights. So the architects going in knew that it wasn't a grant of a license, it was the owner owned it. So that sometimes you can, as an owner, if you're a big enough 800-pound gorilla, you can walk in before any bidding starts and says, whatever you're doing for me, I own it. And so there's all different ways that just depending on the clients and, again, the weight and the authority. Because if somebody gets a really cool contract from a big government project and it gets, you know, lots of accolades and everything else, maybe you don't care if you don't own that copyright because you get all these other things as the architect for marketing. So it's a, but generally, I would say, is you as an architect, hold on to your license. Or hold on to your copyright. Yes, go ahead. So you would argue, like what I would say is, so let's talk about what the type of business it might be. So if you're in a place where there's going to be public going in and out, so you need to see floor plans of where the offices are going to lay out. Like the building we work in, which you guys will come see, and I'll send out, I'm just reminding myself here, I'll send out dates or a couple suggested dates for the pizza party after the exam, midterm. Every time a new tenant comes in, they're going to do a build out. Well, the architect, the company coming in, like when our firm went into this space, we didn't want to have to call up the architect and do that. We brought in our own architect and we dealt with the building manager. We got a floor plan and showed where all the electrical, all the plumbing, all everything else. And so, yes, they can do that for that. As a homeowner, I don't know if I'd be putting out your floor plan for anybody to see because then somebody could break in because they know where your safe room is or whatever, if you have a safe room. But so, yes, generally it's for the use. If you go back, let me see if it's on that thing, I believe. The license includes using the project. And if the project itself is development, if it's residential, if it's commercial, and you need to use those drawings for your ongoing business, it's in this license. Yep. Okay, so 7.4 is what happens if the owner decides to do something else? Maybe they use these instruments or services and somewhere along the line the architect and the owner don't get along. So we have here, or what if the event the owner uses the instruments or service without retaining the author of the instruments or services. The owner releases the architect and the architect's consultants from all claims and causes of actions arising from that use. So let's go back to that plot of land just off of Lakeshore Drive there north of Addison. If that developer went ahead and built those towers and didn't hire the previous architect, it would be a breach of the contract because they didn't have the right because it was outside the project. But let's say there was some wiggle room in whether the project contemplated two more towers. It wasn't the project, whatever, so we're not quite sure. It's not clear. But he hires a different architect to administer the drawings and make sure the project is being built in accordance with some other architect's drawings. And there's an injury in the project, or a wall falls down, or whatever may happen. Architect A that designed it, based on this, is free and clear from any claims related to that. Released from all claims and causes of actions arising from the use of the architect. So if architect B and owner uses A's drawings, something goes wrong with the project, A is clear. Because A knows the drawings, and they're going to say, well, you know what, if I was on the project site, I'm a better architect than architect B, I would have seen that wall fall down. So you can't blame me for something that I never had an opportunity to miss. It's fair. It should be in there. So that's a good provision to protect yourself. So, continuing on, the owner should expect from the law further agrees to indemnify and hold harmless architects and consultants for all costs and expenses. This concept here of indemnity, I'm not going to go into great detail because I will tell you this, and it's not any disparagement to my other fellow lawyers. Indemnity is a very complex concept. So you're not going to have to understand how indemnity works, but I will just tell you what it is so you understand it in this context. There will not be an indemnity question on this paragraph. I just want you to understand it, though. Wall falls down. So architect A designs the building. They build it. Fine, we're good. Owner decides to build the same building, the exact same one, and the right next to it. Builds the building but uses architect B. They build it, there's no problems with the construction, everything seems to go fine, people start moving in, and a wall falls down and kills a tenant. So it's not Architect A, it's not Architect B, and it's not the owner. It's a third party, somebody that just decided to move in and got smushed by a wall. But they're going to sue. So they're going to sue owner, because it was the building that they're renting from. They're going to sue the Architect B, because that Architect B was there to make sure the building went up correctly. And we know that the owner can't sue Architect A, because the first sentence says, I can't sue you, I've released you. But the guy that got smushed, or his family, they don't care, because they don't have a contract with anybody. So they sue Architect A as well. And Architect A is like, I wasn't even around. How can you come after me? And the family of the guy that got smushed says, I don't care that you weren't around. It was your design. I'm suing you. It's a third party. What this sentence says is, indemnify and hold harmless. What this means is, owner must defend Architect A. Hire the lawyer to defend Architect A. And if there's a judgment against Architect A, the owner must pay it. Because the owner used these drawings without the permission. So indemnity deals with a third party, not the parties in the deal, the original deal, or even the secondary deal. It's this third party out there, somebody that doesn't have a contract, it's not related to any of the game or the deal. That person gets injured and they sue somebody that shouldn't have been sued or wouldn't have been sued normally. The owner in this case has to be the protector, indemnifying that Architect A. Happens all the time in construction. Indemnities in every single construction contract you have. Who gets indemnified, who has the rights, who's not, that gets wiggled around depending on who has more leverage. But indemnity happens all the time in construction. So I wanted you to understand that there's this third-party concept because there's always somebody out there that's visiting the mall, coming to your house, going to the hospital, living in a condo, whatever it is, that could potentially sue the original parties, which are, if you go back to that, Groucho Marx and Harpo Marx, party in the first part, party in the second part. Those are the people in the contract. Third parties outside of the contract. Okay? Any questions on that? I don't want to... there'll be another time where we'll talk a little bit about indemnity and I'll give you a little bit more flavor on it, but I just want you to understand that, because it'll come up next week in torts, but that's kind of about the level I need you guys to understand it. And then the other thing is if you're ever in a situation where you or your company's getting sued, and you're like, we had nothing to do with that, that's when you call your lawyer and say, am I indemnified here? Did my contract indemnify me? Because Hanahan told me under 731 I should be indemnified. So that's what you want to do there. You don't have to call me, but just call somebody. So let somebody else handle the indemnity world. And they talk about cost expenses, including related claims, cost of defense, cost of the action. So that's all the legal fees and everything else. And expenses that arise from the owner's use of the instruments of service under the Section 731, which is without the permission. The terms of the Section 731 shall not apply if the owner rightfully terminates this agreement under cause for Section 9.4. So that's the owner's get-out-of-jail-free card. This talks about, hey, I'm using your drawings, Architect A, and I don't have your permission. Well, maybe it's because you were such a deadbeat, or you weren't making your numbers, or you lied to me, or all these other things that could have happened, and I had to fire you. And I didn't want to go back and start from the beginning, and I paid you for everything you did, but I still had to fire you. I'm allowed to use your drawings with Architect B, but because you were such a deadbeat and you breached this agreement, if something goes wrong and you get sued, that's your problem. So this protection of indemnity and hold harmless is if the architect does everything they're supposed to do. I performed, I fell within the contract, you were the ones that wrongfully took my drawings. But it doesn't happen if the architect breached the contract, failed to do their work, missed the deadlines, whatever it is, and the owner was forced to get rid of you because of your breach. So that's fair too. I mean, it's fair that you're protected if owner and Architect B are doing their own gig. Should be protected. But if it's because of you, the owner shouldn't have to protect you. So it's a pretty fair, equally balanced provision. Does that make sense? Okay. Last one in Article 7. Except for the license granted under this section. So it's just basically saying what's in this section. That's it. No other license or right shall be deemed granted or implied in this agreement. Doesn't include anything else. Like if I didn't give you a license for this or that or my papers or whatever, some things that don't fall within the definition of instrument services, you can't use them. So any unauthorized use of the instrument service shall be at the owner's sole risk. If I am using it outside of for the use, maintenance, care of this sole project, so I use it for the second one, that's at my risk, without liability to the architects and the architect's consultants. So it's another, this kind of reiterates what was said in the previous one about indemnification. This again, this last sentence is there to protect you. So, now sometimes you're going to see, and again, won't be an exam, but just to talk about it. Sometimes you're going to see provisions where some architect's going to add that says, we get the rights to photograph your space upon completion, and our license, and you grant us a license to publish those photographs. Or our license includes what we give you because we own the copyrights. If we take photographs of it, that falls within our copyright, so we can use it for marketing purposes. The owner sometimes will say, you're not allowed to take any pictures without our approval, so if you want to put these into your brochures or your marketing material, send it to me first and we'll clarify that. All these different types of things that certain owners will have discussions with you. It's not in the basic agreement, but be prepared for that as you start to get more sophisticated and well-known owners as clients. Even private residents, I mean, they don't want you to be putting their inside of their houses on their website necessarily. It could be the outside, but maybe not where the rooms are otherwise. Okay, Article 8, claims. So remember, we talked about claims and disputes in the beginning. There's breach of contract, and if you have a breach of contract, you have a claim. So the contract here needs to explain what a claim is and what do you do with it. So, and claim in this concept is tied to disputes between the parties. Who screwed up? What's the cost? What are those things? So that's what the claims are here. Owner and architect shall commence all claims and causes of actions, whether in contract, tort, we'll talk about that next week, or otherwise, against the other blah, 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 within a period specified by the applicable law, but in any case not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion of the work. So, if you remember, we talked about Illinois and the concept of a statute of limitations. Do you remember that thing that said, if it's a contract, you can bring that written contract within 10 years, or a contract within 5 years, but if it's in the construction, it's 4 years when you knew or should have, but then there's that 10-year period, so there could be 14 years total. Do you remember that? Okay. So, kind of think about that, because there may be the closest thing we have in a math question on the exam as far as when dates fall and stuff like that. This is trying to address it as on a national level. The AAA contracts are used in every state in the country. They're often used in other countries as well, or similar versions of them. And so each state has their own different statutes of limitations. So the first part, applicable law, says the first thing we're going to look at to see what the statute is in that state. So if there's an action that happens in Minnesota, it's 6 years, no matter what. That includes discovery or anything else. 6 years. If it's after 6 years, you don't have any claim, either architect or owner against architect, about what happened in the building. So if the roof starts leaking on day one of year 7, owner can't sue the architect for design malpractice. Even if it is design malpractice, statute of limitations cut it off. So that's applicable law. But if you're in Illinois, as remember, you can have 10 years to discover that leaky roof and then 4 more years after that. So that's 14 years. So this covers, and there's, I think, there's like 4 states that do that, 3 states that do that, that have this extended period. So it gets in its kicker here that says, but not more than 10 years after the date of substantial completion. And we talk about substantial completion is when you can use that building for its intended purposes. So I've moved into my house, I've started classes at school, I'm making my toys at my factory, whatever that means. That's the substantial completion date. And this caps it at 10 years. So it's either the shorter period by that state's applicable law, or at the most 10 years. Which is good for Illinois if you get it signed like that, because then they can't use that whole 14-year stretch. If I'm representing an owner, I always strike that last one. I always strike the 10 years because I want all 14 for my owner. But as you, as the architect, whatever state you're in, you want to keep it at 10 if you can. Or if it's shorter in your state, that's even better. So, but I represent a lot of owners, so I strike that second one. And then it says, the owner, the architect, waive all claims and causes of actions not commenced in accordance with this section 811. So, even though the statute of limitations, the statute itself says you can't bring a claim, so everybody really knows what this means, we wrote it into the contract as well. This is kind of like a belt and suspenders provision, but it's so the owner that doesn't go to the statute book and doesn't call his lawyer or her lawyer, the owner is notified, this is all we got. After that period of time, I can't bring a claim against you, I'm done. And that's another one where I've had owners or architects or contractors that I've represented, and when the project and the problem occurs in the beginning, you don't know when it's been discovered, you don't know when the statute may kick off. And there have been times where you get paid as a lawyer and then you have to tell your client, oh, by the way, I've done enough discovery now, you have no lawsuit because you're outside the statute of limitations. They don't like those calls either, but it happens. Because this provision here or the statute itself. Question here.
And this is referring to when it starts if any form of brings the claim. Say you file a claim a day before 10 years is over.
Mm-hmm.
You still have that time for the trial.
Yes. It's when you initiate the cause of action of the claim. And that initiation would be either formally filing it with a court of law, or if there's an arbitration provision, which this we'll get to a section shortly, that allows you to use arbitration as your dispute resolution process, that you send a letter to the American Arbitration Association making a demand. So it has to be some written formal process that started in the arbitration or litigation. It doesn't count if you do mediation, because mediation is a non-binding. So it has to be something that will result in a binding resolution of what the claim is. And once you've done that, if you've hit that date, then you're fine and you're within the statute of limitations, and then you can proceed with a lawsuit, and the lawsuit could take it. Well, just as an example, I had a case that we filed in 2019, and we were within the statute of limitations. That case is still not over. We are still litigating it. But we were close. There's actually people saying, oh, you're not within the statute of limitations. We were within about 30 days, but we were well within the wire. And X number of years later, we're still dealing with it. So, the longest case, I think, at one point in time during my course of practice in Illinois, or in the Cook County area, was the Deep Well Project? Is that what it's called? I'm trying to remember. But, you know, when you look out at Lake Michigan, you see those places where the pumping stations is. They're like 4 or 5 miles off the water. So those pumping stations pump water to 7 specific suburban areas in the Chicagoland area. At least one of them. I think the other one goes to south. But in any event, there was work that went down because it goes miles down underwater, and then all the tunnel and the pipes that go and then branch out to the various different subdivisions and anything else. There were injuries during some of the beginning of that project, and I think those cases at one point was like it's 16 or 17 years, those cases are still pending. They're all within statute of limitations, but the slow creeping of the law sometimes takes a while. So I never worked on them, but I know that I know a lot of lawyers made a lot of money over those years because they took so long. So, okay, 812. There's nothing highlighted here. Let me see if there's anything important here. Oh, this talks about insurance. We'll get to that in a second. 813. The architect and the owner waive consequential damages for claims, disputes, or other matters in question arising out of or relating to this agreement. Consequential damages is another kind of one of those, nobody really knows what that means. Even lots of lawyers fight about what consequential damages are, so I'm not going to give you a big test on it. But waiver of consequential damages, but I will tell you, it must be in every one of your agreements. You must demand that the owner waives their consequential damages against you. Why? So we have what's called direct damages in construction, or any injury, any claim, and we have consequential damages. If you designed me a factory to make candy, and the factory had problems in some construction. The cost to fix those construction problems are direct damages. It relates directly to the design and construction of the project. If I told you that I was going to start making candy on October 1st and starting to sell it to the public, and as a result of your design errors or the construction errors, the project was delayed and the candy didn't start getting made until December, that's October and November, and probably some of December, of lost revenue. Lost revenue is a consequential damages. It's a real damage. My candy company isn't making money. It is losing money. And it's losing money because you were delayed or your contractor screwed up. But it's a consequence as opposed to a direct. Companies, architects and contractors, certainly for large businesses, can't afford the pay consequential damages. I think I told you I worked on a casino once. $1 million a day just for the one-armed bandits. That company made $1 million a day. If you had a general contractor and the project was 30 days late, I mean, that's $30 million. But just the one-armed bandits, that doesn't include the roulette wheels, the poker table, like all the other stuff. I mean, the millions, and it would put the general contractor out of business. Same with the architect. So you must have a waiver of consequential damages in your contracts. It's here. Don't let anybody strike it. If they do, they better write a big check for you somehow. That's what it is. It's a non-direct damage. It's a consequence. And it could include the salaries for the people that work for the company. It includes insurance. There's all these, you know, bank financing charges, all this stuff that has nothing to do with the project itself, the direct damages. Question?
Would there be circumstances where you would write out what those consequential damages might be?
Very much so. Yes, yes. And I have provisions. What I'll normally do is I'll say consequential damages including but not limited to. And I have like 8 paragraphs. But I also include but not limited to. So we know the ballpark of where we're sitting in case we don't have to fight about those later. But it still includes that not limited to, because if it comes up and I can prove there's a consequential damage. And the reason why to write it out like that and include the not limited to is because there's a lot of still, to this day, you know, hundreds of years of the world's concept of the concept of consequential damages, that people still fight over, is this a consequence or a direct damage? So it's a very good tactic to put in detail into this paragraph. A2. Mediation. I've talked about mediation. Mediation. So what the AIA did is they want to, as a governing body, and understanding the cost of construction litigation. Construction litigation is some of the most expensive litigation. Just think of all the paperwork. And I know now a lot of it's electronic, but I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of documents. I've been on cases where there's been over 1 million documents. And so just the cost alone of reviewing the documents, and even when you get down to trial, like you get down to trial and you have, you know, maybe you have a half a dozen issues, there's still 1,000 documents that are key documents for that case. So it's very labor-intensive, and litigation costs in construction is really expensive. So the AAA and many other organizations that create, I'm sorry, not the AAA, but the American Institute of Architects, the AIA, and many other organizations that create form documents, like the general contractors have their own form documents, the Design Build Institute of America have their own, engineers have their own, AIA are the most common, but there's all these other form documents out there. They all recognize the need to try to reduce the cost of disputes. They know disputes come up in construction, but they don't want the parties to spend more money with the lawyers than they can ultimately recover or have to pay. It can be a brutal system. So, what do? We do mediation. Mediation is a non-binding resolution where you get a mediator, a third-party independent, and he or she will listen to the grievances between the various parties. And that mediator will then be, most of the time, will be highly educated in both the area of the law and I don't think I've ever... Yeah, I've had a few mediators that have been subject matter experts, but not lawyers, but most mediators are lawyers, so they understand how the law is going to play out, and they understand how the case would play out if it went into courts or arbitration. And so the parties will air their grievances to the mediator. The mediator will then do shuttle diplomacy going back from party to party to try to make a business resolution instead of spending gobs and gobs of money on the litigation parts. Remember, we did the anatomy of the case, and we got to the discovery section, where that's like 80% of all your construction of your litigation costs falls in that discovery section. So maybe 70. But the mediator will be the one that tries to resolve that. So the AIA, in recognizing that that is a good system, include a mediation requirement in their contracts. It is required. Unless this is stricken, you must mediate your case. And it says, any claim, dispute, or otherwise other matter in question arising out of or related to this shall be subject to mediation. Shall is, everybody does it, royal edict. We must mediate this case. And it's a good thing. I have been much more successful mediating cases, making clients happy, at least happy that they're out of the problem, than dealing with the trials and tribulations of being on trial or in arbitration. If you have to get to the full-blown arbitration or trial, it's so much more expensive, and nobody's happy. Now, good mediation, both parties walk away grumbling, but they don't hate their lawyer. A lot of times after litigation, the client never wants to talk to the lawyer again because it was so expensive. So, now, it does talk about this thing, this concept. So if the matter relates to a subject of a lien, the architect may proceed in accordance with applicable law to comply with a lien notice or filing deadlines. So there is an exception. While this mandates mediation between the parties first, a lien is a legal attachment to title. It's called a mechanics lien. So I own property, and I have title to that property as an owner. If I don't pay someone, or if there's some other... Somebody can attach a lien to that property, and that lien sits on top of that. Some banks don't like that because the bank owns the mortgage and they're sitting on that. So it has to sit on that. Under the laws of the United States, anything that deals with property must be litigated in court. Cannot be arbitrated. A lien cannot be mediated. It has to go through the court system. That's just the way land is dealt with. There can be a bazillion other disputes going on as far as the case, but if it's a lien, the architect or the owner can go to court and deal with it that way. Sometimes you can still mediate it and resolve the lien issue during that period of time, but you can't, if it's only a lien issue, you can't mediate just the lien. You have to do that in court. So, any questions on the concept of mediation? A22. The owner and architect shall endeavor. Shall is you must. Endeavor is try really hard. You must try really hard to resolve claims and disputes and other matters between them by mediation. And then it talks about you can use the American Arbitration Mediation. There's different other types of mediation organizations, JAMS, there's various private mediators. You can do all what you want. This calls for the AAA. For certain cases that I have that are high level and high scale, I have a half a dozen nationally known mediators that I plug in because they're the best in the country in this project. If it's a $200 million project, I'm not giving it to somebody that's working, you know, a lawyer out of here. I'm going to give it to somebody that has the gravitas and experience. So, I've had the benefit of working with some of the best mediators in the country. Like one guy that there was the Microsoft case that got mediated between Microsoft and Apple. I've mediated with him and some other people. So, because the cases were important. So, and then you can also. The mediation shall proceed in advance of binding dispute resolution proceedings. So mediation is non-binding, arbitration and litigation are binding. So you have to mediate before you arbitrate or litigate. Now that doesn't mean they can't go at the same time, but before you actually say, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the mediation would take place. In fact, many times mediations take place literally a week or within a few weeks of the real trial, as a maybe it's the second or third or fourth mediation, as kind of a last-ditch effort to try to resolve the dispute, so we don't have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on trials. So, talks about staying in the mediation for 60 days, some other stuff, but really just what you want to understand here is they shall try really hard to mediate, and that trying really hard to mediate has to take place before you actually are presenting in front of an arbitrator or a jury or judge. 824. If the parties do not resolve the dispute through mediation, which happens often, then we need to do one of these three binding binding dispute resolution processes. So in the 2017, the 2007s and the 1997, this was mandatory arbitration. Arbitration came out as a kind of an alternate to litigation in the 50s and 60s. It was supposed to be better, faster, cheaper, and more educated panel members. You would have somebody that's educated in the system. They're a construction lawyer, they're a general contractor, they're an architect. So they knew what was going on, as opposed to just some judge that had been recently elected by the general public that just, you know, doesn't know the stuff. And litigation, true litigation, can be bogged down with lots of things that happen, you know, like fighting over this motion or trying to get this person this deposition, all that discovery part that I pointed out in the anatomy of the lawsuit, that huge cost. So arbitration was created to cheapen everything. Not cheapen, but make it less expensive. Cheap is a bad word. To make it less expensive. Unfortunately, we're all lawyers and we're all used to our own things. Arbitration is not any less expensive than litigation anymore. And so the American Institute of Architects recognized that, and they now don't mandate arbitration. You get to check a box. But that box needs to be checked in the beginning when you're negotiating the contract. So when you're sitting down, you say to, I'm the owner and you're the architect, and I say, well, we have to mediate, so we know that. Like maybe we can pick a mediator now, or we can use the system that's in the document. So we do that. And then we say to each other, do you want to arbitrate this, or do you want to litigate it? I, as a lawyer, counsel my clients, either owner, architect, or contractor, doesn't matter. I almost always check litigation because I don't find personally arbitration to be any more beneficial. I find it actually to be worse for a whole host of reasons. The biggest one is there's no such thing as appeal. You can appeal a court system. If a court judge, a case comes down and the judge screwed up, you can appeal it to the appellate court. If the arbitration panel screws up, you're done. You're stuck with it. There's nothing you can do unless you can show bias, you know, like one of the arbitrators was married to the defendant's sister or something like that. But it's really difficult to overturn arbitration. So on that very basis, I don't like arbitration. I also find some of the lack of, they don't have as many rules, like evidence rules and how things are done. So you get these arbitrators who are just kind of like at the Wild West. And that's happened in a number of arbitrations for me. So when I advise a client, we check litigation. However, some clients don't want that. Some clients are private clients. So when you're litigation, it's a public court filing and everybody can see. So if I represent somebody that's a private individual, they may want to have an arbitration because it's supposed to be confidential. Or when we did stuff with Navy Pier, we always did arbitration because a number of their money was that they raised for Navy Pier came from foundations, and they didn't want to have the people that were making donations to Navy Pier being put into the public record and the value of their donations. So for certain public entities or charitable entities, they may be arbitration. But you check either one. There's an other specified, you don't have to worry about that. I've never checked this. There are methods. One's called VDARB, one's called RB. There's other stuff you can put here. You don't have to worry about it. You're basically going to do arbitration or mediation. Questions on that? Arbitration. See, now I have to say, if you check the arbitration box, now you can figure out how we do arbitration. If you don't check the arbitration box, I just strike these provisions in the agreement and move on. But since I got to tell you what's in it, I'm going to tell you. If they selected arbitration, it shall be subject to the arbitration which, unless the parties mutually agree otherwise, because you can get your own arbitration panels in a different model, shall administered by the American Arbitration Association in accordance with construction industry arbitration rules. So there's specific rules under the American Arbitration Association that govern how construction cases should operate. Those rules are a little different than commercial arbitrations. Commercial would be like, you know, just two business owners or an individual and a business owner. So commercial stuff. So there's just some different tweaks here and there. They're very similar, but they have a set of rules to follow. And I would say in the States, most, I would say probably at least if it goes to arbitration, probably 80 to 90% will go through the AAA. They do the best they can do, and sometimes you just get bad arbitrators, but it's a decent system. So if you have to do it, which, like I said, I don't like to, but sometimes I do, most of the time there are basic good guardrails in place to get a good outcome. Not always, and I've had both. I've had worse outcomes in arbitration, in my opinion, as to how the cases are managed. Not necessarily the results, like the awards I've had in arbitration have generally been where they should be. But the management of the case or how things go down during the arbitration sometimes aren't as good because you don't have the guardrails like you do in court. A311, demand for arbitration shall be made no earlier than concurrent with the filing for the request for mediation. So you must mediate. So if you're an architect and you get a letter from your owner that said, I'm filing a demand for arbitration against you, but no one's ever asked you to mediate, you write back and say, C8311, I don't have to do anything until we mediate this case. You haven't asked for mediation. So you must go in the steps. And this was added for that very purpose. People would just want to jump right into arbitration and not mediate. They're like, no. We're going to mediate because actually mediation probably could settle this case. Good lawyers will try to settle a case of mediation. And it also recognizes this concept of statute of limitations. Shall not be after the date of the institution of a legal or equitable proceeding based on the claim, blah, 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 may be barred by the applicable statute of limitations. So if you remember back in Article 6, we talked about the time period of when you can file that, you know, within the applicable statutes or the 10 years. This is referring to it. Just because we're doing arbitration doesn't mean we can blow off the rules of when we need to file that formal complaint. It's not just in litigation, it's also arbitration, which goes to what your question was. So, So A32 basically says at the end of an arbitration, you're going to get the panel. It could be one arbitrator, or it's one or three, depending on how big the judgment or the dispute is. They're going to give you a judgment. It could be party A owes party B $1 million. It could be literally a single sentence like that, or it could be what's called a reasoned decision where they give you, here's what we thought, and here's why, and here's the law, and everything else. So it could be very detailed. Either way, party A owes party B $1 million. That's the bottom line. That can be enforced in court. In fact, what you do is you take that judgment and you go over to court and you file it with them just to make sure that if the party A doesn't want to pay party B, then you can sue party A in court, not in arbitration, for failing to follow the arbitration rule. It's a back check. Arbitrators, their decision is binding by law, but if somebody blows it off, you got to have the law to enforce it. So that's what this provision says here. And the decision rendered is final. That's that whole thing of no more appeal. So you can enforce it at a state court, but you cannot appeal it unless you can show, like I said, bias or otherwise. Consolidation or joinder. I'm just going to talk really quickly about this. It's really simple. And you're not going to have this on the test, but I just want you to understand the concept here. In construction, we've got owner, architect, contractor, subconsultants on the architect side, your mechanical engineer, electrical engineer, blah, 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 all the subcontractors on the contractor side. Lots of different parties. But if we think about the triangle, owner, architect, owner, contractor, those are the only two contracts the owner has. And the architect has all these down here and everything else. What happens if the owner sues the architect in arbitration? The owner can't sue the electrical engineer because they don't have a contract with them. They only sue the architect. Because the electrical lights aren't working right or whatever. And ownership is the contractor, because when the lights aren't working, they're not sure if the contractor screwed up or the architect screwed up, so I'm going to sue both of them. So I got a lawsuit, one lawsuit, or one arbitration demand. That arbitration demand is against architect and contractor only. The architect's like, I didn't do any of the designs. Contractor's like, I didn't build it. My subcontractors, there's all these other people down here that I need to pull in. They can be joined or consolidated into that single action. What you don't want is arbitration 1, owner, architect. Arbitration 2, owner, contractor. Arbitration 3, architect, electrical engineer. Arbitration 4, contractor, electrical subcontractor. Because they can have different decisions and people are spending a lot more money and everything else. So this concept allows them to be consolidated and joined so long as their provisions and their contracts allow that to happen. So this provision here is what we call a flow down provision. The arbitration agreement with the other parties permits consolidation. So you want to make sure that your architect flows that down to their contract with the electrical engineer or the general contractor. And that's why the American Institute of Architects has this suite of contracts. They already have all the flow down provisions built in. So one of the things that this provision I actually teach you for, the whole concept of consolidation kind of is like, let's get everybody the same party. That's what you need to know about what the purpose of this provision is. Everybody needs to be the same dance. The secondary reason I put this in here, that I want you guys to understand this, is that, remember, you're the first person that's talking to the owner. And you say, let's use an AAAB 101. You know what is favorable for you. It's a good document and you've used it a bunch of times, so you're more familiar with the owner. Good move on your part. You draft that up, and then you go to the owner, and we're going to bring in a contractor, and you're going to say, let's use the AIA, A101, and A201 for the contractor, because I know all the protections that's in my B101 are in that A201. And you guys will see that in the next couple weeks. Oh, and by the way, when I get in my EE or my ME or my SE, I'm going to use the C301 or 302 or whatever it is, and I'm going to use my C for consultant or subcontractor, and I'm going to bring those in. And so we're all working under the same suite of documents, that all the terms are the exact same definitions, and all these flow-down provisions are included. Simple. One-stop shop. That's great. And it's important. What happens if the owner doesn't want to use an AIA, but it looks like an AIA? Then your job is to make sure that the other provisions and the other agreements has this flow down. So flow down provisions exist in contracts. I wanted to point this out as this is one. Keep it with AIA. That's my strong recommendation to every architect out there, because they're very good for you. But if you have to go off the board, make sure you protect yourself. Because the last thing you want to do is sue that electrical engineer and have to sue them in state court while you're sitting over here in arbitration and you're fighting two different battles. And your insurance company's not happy with you, and the owner's not happy with you, and the lawyer's happy with you because he's getting paid for two different lawsuits. So, it's not good for my business, but I don't want you to do that. So, question back there. Yes. In fact, many owners will take the AIA, as I think I said earlier, and they'll take the provisions in the AIA that they like, and they'll put them in their own form document, and they'll make a few tweaks, and technically they're copyright infringement, but you know, who's going to go and sue some giant conglomeration and go after them like that? And so they'll take and modify and choose the provisions they like. Some owners or some even architects, because you have to pay a software fee to generate these documents without the draft watermark on them, will say, forget that, I'm just going to copy and paste it onto my own document and then I don't have to pay the software fee and I'll just crank that out. Again, it's a copyright infringement. It's in violation of actually Article 7 that they'll use in their benefit, but they'll use their own tweaked version. It's not the best, I don't recommend it, but I've seen plenty of non-form documents used in projects. So, and in fact, there's some documents that, like the AIA, their suite of documents, don't even have the right form. So there's this concept called an EPC contract. It's like a design build, but it's like a design build on steroids is the best way I would say it. The AIA doesn't have a good EPC contract. So I have, my partners and I have developed a very good form EPC that we use with our clients. and it's much more beneficial for those projects. Those are the projects that are in the hundreds of millions, and they have their own specialties, and we include things that are not even addressed. Because you can only have so many forms. So there are times when you don't want to use them. But like I said, I'd say 75 to 80% of all construction contracts fall into this world. Maybe probably 70, 75. And then this allows you to put joinder provisions in the other one. This is 8.3.4.2 allows you to stick joinder provisions downstream. So this is the secondary part of the flow down concept. Any questions on 8 as far as dispute resolution claims? All right. We're in time. Good. Termination or suspension, Article 9. So now we've had problems. We've brought these claims. Claims aren't working out. The marriage isn't going well. Something's going on in the project. We may need to terminate, or at the very least, we may need to suspend the project. We may need to stop it for some reason. So, what do we do with that? 9.1. If the owner fails to make payments, the architect, in accordance with the agreement, such failure shall be considered a substantial non-performance and cause for termination, or if the architect's option, cause for suspension of performance of services under the agreement. So if I don't get paid, why should I keep working? And I can do one of two things. I can say, owner, you're fired, pay me what I'm owed. Or what I would recommend, because if you start firing your owners, then maybe you don't get more owners' work. Maybe you say, I'm going to stop working for you until we come even. Just depends on how many times that happens. It's kind of like, you know, 1, 2, 3 strikes, you're out. Maybe you don't terminate right away. Maybe you float them. But there's no hard and fast rule. These are business decisions. But this provision gives you the option of either stopping services and then stop designing if they pay me, or you're fired. So, now, if you decide to give them the chance to suspend, you got to give them notice, 7 days written notice. There's all these rules in here about when you need to tell them, so the owner has a chance to make good or whatever it is. But it makes it real clear to the owner, before I resume, I'm going to send you the notice. No, I'll pay you, keep working. And you can say, hey, this provision here says, I shall be paid the sums due prior to the suspension and any expenses incurred in the interruption and resumption of my services. So, maybe it's a month before you pay. Maybe it's 2 months. Maybe you had to wind down the project and you have to wind it back up. You're going to have costs for that. Maybe you've reallocated some of your designers that are working on it. You got to bring somebody back in up to speed. If the owner's not paying you, this says you're entitled to those additional costs. Those are not built in. It's not just like pay my bill past due. It's here's some extra costs that I'm going to have. And then the architect's fees for the remaining services at the time scheduled shall be equitably adjusted. So the timing, like I was supposed to be finished with all my drawings by August 1st, but you didn't pay me for 3 months. So I'll give you the stuff by the end of the year, whatever that might be. This allows you to have leverage for your negotiation to say to the owner, this is the consequences of you not paying me. Your project is going to be delayed. It's not my fault. And I'm not going to be picking up the costs. In fact, you have to pick up my costs. 9.2, if the owner suspends the project, you know, I need some financing, I'm going to have you sit pencils down for a while. The architect shall be compensated for services performed prior to the notice of suspension. Okay, that's fine, pencils down. Here's my bill through pencils down, you have to pay me. And then when the project is resumed, because you owner told me to put pencils down, I also get my costs of stopping and starting up. And the architect's fees for remaining services and schedules shall be equitably adjusted. Same thing. So sometimes it's not this separation or this the owner can't pay. The owner just puts pencils down, gives you the directness, says, I want to keep you on, but we just have to slow things down for whatever it is. This, again, protects you. This is what you want to make sure you're taking care of here. 9.3. If the owner suspends the project for more than 90 cumulative days, for reasons other than the fault of the architect may terminate this agreement by giving 7 days written notice. So if he says pencils down and it's been more than 3 months, you, under this provision, can terminate the agreement. As a guy who represents owners, I strike this provision immediately. I can justify that if I haven't paid or my owner hasn't paid an architect, that the architect's allowed to walk. But life is life and things happen, and if the architect will be compensated under 9-2 or 9-1 for their downtime and their reamping up, why does it matter whether it's 2 weeks or 90 days? As long as I'm paying you, architect, for your downtime and getting back up to speed, the penalty to me, because I'm trying to make money, I'm trying to get my investors, whatever's happening in life, the penalty to me is if you're allowed to terminate me under 9-3, I got to start from scratch because I don't even own the rights to these documents. So, this provision you will see stricken in almost, not almost all, but often it will be stricken. If you can keep it in there, great. Don't die on the hill for this one, though, because you have protections in 9-1 and 9-2. It's okay. Like I said, it's great if it stays in there. If you have an unsophisticated owner and they just go ahead and sign the document, which happens lots, good for you, and you can always terminate. But do you really also want to terminate, too? Wouldn't it be better for you to say, hey, can we work this through? Are you going to make sure you're going to take care of me under 9-2? Do you have a question?
Is that something that's negotiated between the owner and the tenant?
So it's normally going to be when before you resume your services. So when they finally come back and knock on your door and say, here's what the start is, then you're going to give them an accounting. You're going to say, you know, right when they tell you to suspend, you're going to send a bill within a couple of days and says, here's my bills to date. And then your clock starts ticking, and is it downtime? Is it because you're keeping people warm on the staff and they're not working somewhere else? Is that a consequential damage? Maybe. But if you can start showing where you had certain things, maybe, and it depends on how you put that together, but when they come back to you and they say, start up again, it could be a project where you had a trailer on site. It's a big project. That's a cost of the work. It's related to the building and the construction. You can give them the bill for the trailer. So there's going to be this, that's where you're going to have a discussion of what's consequential or not, because we already have the waiver of consequential damages. But this concept here of downtime, before they say come back and start working, you say, okay, I will, I'm going to give you an accounting because I have to get 7 days notice before I start. Within that 7 days, you're going to give them an accounting of your downtime and uptime, your ramp up again, and then you give that to them and say, write me that check and then I'll start. So. And as I said, 9-3, like, termination is the worst thing to happen in any construction project. I will tell you that. I have been doing this for 30-some years. I have been on less than a half a dozen projects where there was a termination, whether it was of the architect or the contractor, and all of them were astronomically expensive for everyone. Not just the architect, not just the contractor, everybody, the owner, and nobody's happy. Termination, you do everything you can to survive and work through termination. Even if it's as an architect, you eat your fees, a contractor and otherwise. Now sometimes you have to terminate because they're just so bad and it's going to be so cost detrimental to you. But even then, sometimes the cost for litigating it out and fighting whether it was your fault or their fault, sometimes that can even dwarf what your costs are. So like I get calls often from people that are having a contractor build their house. I get lots of residential calls, and I tell them until they have hard damage of at least $250,000, don't terminate. And I'm happy to write a letter, but more often I would say I'll write a letter for you to put your signature on, and I'm happy to sit in the background to try to resolve this, because you get lawyers involved, and then everybody gets hostile, and then it's bad. So termination is the nuclear option. I would never do it on either side. Sometimes it happens. I've advised clients not to terminate, and they've told me no, they want to terminate. And then they come back later, and they're like, oh, we shouldn't have terminated. I'm like, I know, but now we're a year and a half later, so we got to finish it out. So, but it happens. It's not like it doesn't, but it's the worst thing to do. 9-4. Either party, owner or architect, may terminate this agreement on not less than 7 days written notice should the other party fail substantially to perform in accordance with the term of this agreement through no fault of the party initiating the termination. You remember a few times when we were looking at the license being granted and it referenced this 9.4. This is the one that says if owner properly terminates under 9.4, they get to keep the license. This says either party. I change this to owner because I don't want the architect. The only way I think an architect can terminate an owner is they don't get paid. So you have all those protections in 9.1 and 9.2. But sometimes you keep it even. Sometimes the architect is like a Rem Koolhaas or whatever, and they won't let you change that because these things can happen. The problem with this, and even if I change it to owner, you'll get into negotiation that says, should the other party fail substantially to perform in accordance with the terms of this agreement? That's like the whole pie. So sometimes this provision gets negotiated, gets changed to owner, and you get to determine and you describe what's considered a material breach. You get a little more specificity. This provision is in there because the AIA didn't want to start negotiating what these specific terminations are because they vary from job to job, and they wanted to give equality to this. But if you guys... Again, this is one, I would not be surprised that you'll see this modified to the owner's favor and not the architect's favor. Again, it's not one I would die on the hill for because you have 9.1 and 9.2 to get your costs when you're suspended. But if it's in there and they want to negotiate, it's worth it for them to start having a discussion about what is considered a substantial breach. Because it's, I mean, that sentence, fail substantially perform in accordance with the terms of the agreement, is the embodiment of it depends. That's what that says. Except it's in 10 words instead of 2. So, 5. The owner, now we have a time where the owner can terminate this agreement upon not less than 7 days written notice for the owner's convenience. They can terminate you because they didn't like the color of the tie you wore on the project site. For their convenience. Now this one, again, will probably stay in the agreement because the owner is paying you. The owner has the money. And 9.1 and 9.2 says, as soon as you get to that point where there's a termination or suspension, you get paid through that period of time. So you're always protected. And the owner can always say, I'm the one that wants to walk away. I will advise the owner not to trigger this unless it's dramatic because you're going to have to potentially start over. Or maybe this gets negotiated that if I terminate you for convenience, as long as I've paid for the drawings, I still have my license to use it. But then the owner's at risk for using the drawings without the architect. There's all these repercussions. So 9.3 and 9.4 expected the architect them to be either stricken or modified. 9.5 expect that to stay in. This is where the owner has leverage because they have money. U.S. store of protections. Question?
Yeah, so say the architect hires five
people
for the project. Yes. And then the owner just can't for no reason. Is there any, like, consequential damage there, or is that nothing happens? It doesn't matter if they hire.
So, as a general statement, that's the architect's problem. Because when the architect gave a bid, and when we get to the economics of construction, I'll show you how you figure out math and how many people staff and how many hours. And so the architect should look at the full project and say, this is going to be X number of people hours, design hours, and whatever, and how do I staff that through the course of the project? And that's going to build into how I build my pricing model that will be in this contract. And if your ramping up of parties and everything else happens and then there's a separation for convenience, you have to figure out what to do with that. That is a general purpose. If and when you guys are working with European architects, the European system and the labor laws over there say if a party or an individual is hired specifically for a project, they are guaranteed work. Rem Koolhaas had this provision modified that said, no matter what happens, you must pay the full salary of the three people that he hired for this project, two that stayed over there and one that was here, for 2 years. Didn't matter when the termination happened. Could have day one, could have been day 365, could have been 640. Didn't matter. IIT was responsible for making sure their salaries were paid because the law where their firm was based was a mandated law that they had to take into consideration. So that became arguably a direct damage based on what the law said, and we had to apply that here. But it was a negotiation because we were using Illinois law. So that it can come into play. But by and large, staffing issues would be, I would argue they would fall under consequential as direct, as opposed to direct for that.
Was that for the new hires?
It was only for the new hires. So they had a team, they pitched it, they put it together, and they said, we had discussions about this, and they said, we are going to need to bring on three new people. Two are going to be here, and one's going to be here for us to properly staff it. Because it included them getting to know Illinois law and Illinois, like they had to be conversions from metrics to imperial, blah, blah, blah. There was a lot of stuff that actually had legitimate, and it was a specific high-profile project. So they were hired specifically for this team, and they said, we must guarantee, by our law, them 2 years of employment, whether they're here in the States or over with us. And so that was a negotiation in the contract, and we paid it. So, and there was no termination, and everything came out fine and stuff. But that was built into this, that said, if you terminate us for convenience, you still got to pay our bills. So, if the owner suspends the project, the architect, this goes back and similar to what happened. Oh, wait, we already did this one the wrong way. Sorry. We're at 9-4. Wait, did I do 9-5? Yeah, 9-5. 9-7. Termination expenses are in addition to the compensation for the architects and services and include expenses directly attributable to the termination of which the architect is not otherwise compensated, plus an amount of the architect's anticipated profit on the value of services not performed by the architect. So this says, and it's not applicable necessarily to what you said, because your question was, if the architecture firm hires 3 or 4 or 5 new designers to help on their services. But let's say it's a different one. Let's say it's the architect gets a bill from the electrical engineer, and the contract between the architect and the electrical engineer says, I get paid full price whether you fire me or not. That's a termination expense the architect must pay because it's in their contract. This provision here says, I get my termination expenses. And so the architect in that instance will, if they incur these, will pass additional costs. If they rented a trailer for the site and it was a guaranteed 1 year for the trailer to be on site, and they terminate it within 6 months, and they still have to pay the full year, that's a termination expense. And so there are other expenses that this tries to roll in as not consequential damages, but are directly related to termination. So this is why people are like, what the hell are consequential damages? I mean, isn't that a consequence of me being fired, that you got these additional costs? And the answer is yes, but if it's deemed in the contract as a termination expense, sometimes what you'll have is a provision here that says termination expense will be $100,000, it'll just be a lump sum. Sometimes you put that in. But it's directly attributable to the termination, as opposed to like when the owner doesn't get the factory up and running and can't sell its candy. So there is a direct correlation between that. And then this anticipated profit on the value of services not performed, that one will almost always be stricken by the owner. Because what you're going to say is, well, I bid on this project to do it for $600,000, and built into my model was a $100,000 profit for me, because here's my man hours, here's my designer hours, and here's all the other expenses, and that was going to cost me $500,000, but I'm operating a business as a profit, so my model included $100,000 profit. You fired me 6 months into a year, so I'm losing $50,000. I've already made my $50,000 profit in the first half of that $100,000, but I'm losing $50,000. I get that as well. Owners don't like paying for profit for work you didn't do. So this says I'm terminated, and it just doesn't delineate between cause or for convenience. That would be awful. Like, I'm terminating you because you screwed up and I got to pay your lost profits. So this lost profit provision will likely be stricken. Again, it's not a fight I would die on the hill for, because it's hard to justify paying somebody for work they didn't do. There's other ways to get around that. It's more on the construction side, but I just want you to know, this is a good provision for the architect. It's a likely provision that will be modified by the owner. Question back there.
So is this different from when you talked about the court? I mean, you talked about something like this where the architect was anticipating work or something from that job or something.
Yes.
So is that, and I think in that scenario they were given or they were guaranteed like that or something.
So profit here is tied to value of the services not performed by the architect. So the services here would be tied to this project only, as opposed to the concept where I went ahead, and this is when we were talking about anticipatory or I'm blanking on the name of the provision, not reciprocal damages. Expectation damages, that's what we were talking about, expectation damages. So when I signed up for this project, I expected to get this much money for the work I'm performing, and you fired me, and I wasn't able to use my people on the next project coming up, and I lost money because, or maybe you didn't fire me, maybe the project got delayed and extended, and I had to keep my A-team there. So it wasn't about this, but I expected actually to have my A-team roll over and get a new job. Those are not expectation damages you recover. That would be a consequential, and that would be profits you can't get for this project. You get the cost of keeping your people on time as an expectation damages. This concept says if you're terminated, so if you're terminated, those people are going to be free and can go work on the other job. But if this is terminated, if there are costs, the profits tied to this project that you weren't able to work on, this allows you to get that. But most, like I said, most people strike it. Does that help you clarify what is the difference? Okay. Okay, miscellaneous provisions. We'll kind of blow through these because they're not as relevant. I mean, they're relevant to everything else. If you're going to be arbitration, then you can use the Federal Arbitration Act. That just talks about some rules there. If you're going to be using this, it's going to have the same terms, will have the same meaning as the A201. This is this whole, we can use the same suite of documents. That's in 10.2. 10.3, the owner's architect respectfully bind themselves to their agents, et cetera, et cetera, to this agreement. So everybody that's working under it, including the people downstream, so the subcontractors or subconsultants, actually the consultant side on the architect side, are bound to this prime agreement. Everybody has to follow the rules of the prime agreement so the owner can allow and make sure those flow-down terms happen. And so, as an example, we talked about that one flow-down term of joinder. If the architect in its agreements with its mechanical engineer failed to flow down that provision, even if it's the mechanical engineer that screwed up, the owner can collect from the architect because they're supposed to bind everybody to the same rules. So we're all supposed to be on the same game of Monopoly here. So it behooves you as the architect to use the same terms going downstream. So that's what 10.3 says. Is everybody needs to be on the same board. They're all bound and their agents have to be bound by those as well. 10.4 you don't have to worry about. 10.5, nothing contained in this agreement shall create a contractual relationship with or cause of action in favor of a third party against the owner or the architect. The third party here basically is what you think about as the contractor. This doesn't create any agreement between the contractor and the architect or otherwise, but it's any third party. It's that person walking down the street that falls into a hole on the project site and breaks their leg. They can't use this agreement as mandated that the owner had to follow because the third party didn't sign this contract. This is just clarifying it's between the party in the first part and the party in the second part, not that third party. Unless otherwise required in this agreement, the architect shall have no responsibility for discovery, presence, handling, removal, disposal, or persons of hazardous materials or toxic substances. Contractors are responsible, or the owner, when they're doing their soil reports and everything else, they're the ones that are responsible for if there's toxic stuff in the land. The only time an architect could potentially have a problem with bringing toxic or hazardous materials onto a site is if something in their design required the use of toxic materials. So their design may say, you must use this type of metal that has uranium in it. I mean, I'm making something up here, but there may be something in that there causes toxic materials to come in. That's where an architect would have problems with it. So, but otherwise, that this excludes you from it. It says no responsibility. The architect shall have the right, so this is the one that I said sometimes ties back up with Article 7 with the copyright, shall have the right, it's already built in for you, to include photographic or artistic representations of the design of the project among the architect's promotional professional materials. So that's good for you. Now, like I said, owners may tweak that and say, I need permission first, I need to see what you're publishing, blah, blah, blah. And then confidential proprietary information from the owner can't be published. It can't be like, okay, here's this really cool house and it costs this much money to build. You don't want to do that or stuff. So it limits it. It protects the owner as far as what information would be put in the public sector by the architect. If the architect or owner receives information specifically designated by the other party as confidential or business proprietary, the receiving party shall keep such information strictly confidential. And the owner's budget is going to be one of those things. You do not want to go flashing out the budget. It's not your right, nor should you need to, saying, oh, I'm working with this owner and this is what they're going to do. In fact, sometimes what may even be proprietary and confidential is the name of the client. So there's lots of stuff, and this is to protect both sides. The architect may also have proprietary information. You may sit down with the owner and say, here's these cool things that we've done and only we've done this, and we want to put this into your building. And the owner says, well, that's really cool. And then they go to another lighting designer and stick those drawings up. You can't take the stuff. I mean, so sometimes it's intellectual property, sometimes it's business information, sometimes it's just individuals. This says both parties need to keep things secret. And if you fail to do that, that could be a material breach that justifies termination. Compensation. Almost done. So, you got to get paid for all this. So we get to Article 11. That's like kind of at the end. It's this throwaway provision, but it's not a throwaway provision. This is the one that your CFO really cares about. This is the one that your accounting department cares about. And this is one that actually both you and the owner should care about, too. So, 11.1 says basic services. Here's how much am I charged for basic services, and that's architectural, structural, mechanical, electrical. Way back in Article 3.1 when we defined what basic services are. Additional services, that's that in Article 4, the owner shall be compensated as follows, and you can put in what you do here. Now, under Article 11.1 and 11.2, it could be any model. It could be for 11.1, it could be, we're going to do the basic services for $600,000. Or, we're going to do the basic services on an hourly rate. Or, we're going to do the basic services by phases. Here's the price for phase one, which is schematic. Here's the price for design development. Here's the price for construction documents. And those may be modified as we go along. So what goes in under that price for basic services, what goes in under the price for additional services under the 11.2 and 11.3, those are going to be different for every project. You may have a preferred model. You may say for houses, I have this flat rate for this type of house, and that's what you do. You may say but you're a multi-discipline type firm, and so you may say, these types of projects we always do is hourly. These types of projects we always do is lump sum. So it just depends on the business model, and that's something, I don't give any advice on that here of how to put that together. Just knowing that it's not locked into any one thing. It could be a third common one. So we have hourly, we have lump sum. A third common one is a percentage of the cost of the work. So if I have $1 million, I'll charge you 10% of the cost of the work. So I'm going to get $100,000 for that work because that's 10%. That's a very common methodology too. And then what you're also going to do is in between 11.2 and 11.3, 11.2, you may have already designated a section, half a dozen additional services, but more may come up during the course of the project. This may be, 11.2 may say, additional services will be charged for the price that's already listed in 4.1, because we already know what they are. Additional services that come up afterwards will be hourly, so you can have different models in the way you structure this. Additional services, if I'm hiring a consultant, maybe as a certain percentage or a markup. I get a bill from my electrical engineer for $100. I'm going to charge you a 10% markup. You pay me $110. So there's different ways to do that. This is where this concept of the percentage of the cost of the work comes into play. This 11.5. So as I said, you know, cost of the work is going to be, you know, like if you gave me your budget, so let's say your budget and your cost of work are the same, even though we're still doing estimates, $1 million. So at the end of this project, you're going to pay me $100,000. It's going to be broken up as so the owner can see what the cash flow is going to be. Schematic and design is probably going to be 10% of that 10%. Design development, somewhere between 15 and 20. Construction documents, somewhere between 40 and 45. Bidding and negotiation, between 0 and 5. Construction phase, somewhere around whatever's left. 25, 20, I'm not sure which of my math. And that will get you your total, that will get you to your 100%. So this is something you could fill out. Or it can be stricken. You can say, I'm just doing it for 100,000, then you strike this section. So there's lots of mixing and matching that happens in Article 11. There will be no questions on Article 11 of how it works and everything else. I just want you to see where it is. 11.6. When compensation is based on a percentage of the cost of the work and any portions of the project are deleted or not constructed, compensations for those portions of the project shall be payable to the extent services are performed on those portions. So let's say we have this three-bedroom, three-bath house with a really cool sun porch. And we start designing it, and we're getting in the price and stuff, and it comes in that we've done the design work for the sun porch, and it's going to cost $100,000 for the sun porch. So I get 10 grand for my design services for that, because I've done the work and I'm getting a 10% cost of the work payment model. Owner looks at it and is like, the rest of the house is too expensive. Let's just cut the sun porch out because it's not within my budget. So we get $100,000 off the cost of the work to build the project. Architect still gets its $10,000 for the design services because they did the work. It was the owner that removed that scope and brought the project cost down, but remember, the architect's fees are not in the cost of the work. They're separate. So the architect gets paid for the work it performed, even though the owner isn't going to build it. Same thing that happens if the owner has the price of the project as $1 million, and they're doing it, and it turns out that the cost of the work is based on that, and then they get a little extra cash flow, and they say, will you add the sun porch? It'll cost $100,000. Well, my budget's gone up to $1.1 million. The original fee was going to be $100,000, 10% of the million. Well, I get another $10,000 for that $100,000 design because your budget went up and the cost of the work went up, so I get paid for that design. So the architect gets paid either way, added or subtracted. It's fair. You should not have to do work for free. So there are a couple of caveats. It's based on the lowest bona fide bid, where those prices come in, and then the most recent estimate. That's how you factor in what the cost of that value of the stuff that's been deleted. 11.7, hourly billing rates for the architect and the architect's consultants. You list them. You know, principal architect, senior architect, associate architect, draftman, whatever you do, you'll list all those people out. There'll be a chart of what those hourly rates are. Reimbursable expenses. Like, you're going to have other things than just people drawing time on CAD and stuff. So there's a list here of a whole bunch of stuff. Transportation, expenses and services, fees paid for getting authorities for the jurisdiction, printing and reproduction, postage expenses. Pretty standard stuff that you have as a cost of doing business. And so the owner has to pay you those reimbursable expenses. I think the list continues on to this page. Models, consultants of professional liability insurance, taxes, site office expenses, project related. So there's this list of things that you get in addition to what your fee is in Article 11.1 for basic services, this is an up and extra, because we have to pay for it, so you do it. And 11.8.2 says you pay these reimbursable expenses and you give me a markup. Because I got to carry your cost. I put it on my credit card, I pay it off in a month, but you don't pay me back for another month. I got to carry those fees. That's 2 months of me carrying this cost, so I should get a 5% or a 10% markup on that. That's always a negotiated amount. The highest I've seen is 15%. Somewhere between 0 and 5 is pretty common. Compensation for the architect's use of the instruments of service. This goes back to one of those questions as far as we had. If there's a termination, and they terminate the agreement under Section 9.3, the architect terminates, or the owner terminates for convenience. The owner says, I still want to use these drawings. So maybe you want to walk away, architect, because it's been suspended too long, but the drawings I still want to use. Or maybe I want to terminate you because I don't like the color of your tie. But if I pay you a licensing fee, can I still use your drawings? I still have to protect you if somebody else screws up, you got the indemnity, blah, blah, blah. But I don't want to start from the beginning. And so a lot of times you'll put in this lump sum. Yeah, you can have my full set and that license will continue even though we've parted our ways for 100 grand or 10 grand or whatever it is. This can be negotiated later too. I would say less than 5% of my contracts that I've drafted in 35 years put something in this box. People don't want to start trying to guesstimate. They don't want to anticipate that somebody's going to get fired. So they leave it open. And then when we get to the back end of the project, then we negotiate what the value is of keeping the license active. So that would be my recommendation, but it happens both ways. But yes, question.
I'm sure people should start with the updated version, but 11.9.
It is talking about the architect's insurance. That's the one I handed out to you guys? Mm-hmm. You know, because I struck the insurance stuff. Well, but we had 2.5, right? We talked about 2.5 with the insurance, right? Mm-hmm. So in the version I sent you, it's in 11?
It's 11.9.
Okay. Thank you for. Then I'll have to go back to them. So is this 11.10?
It's broken up into smaller portions, it looks like. Basically what you're saying, that it's broken up.
Oh. There's the progress payments. Okay. All right, well.
Yeah.
Oh, let me go back. Oh, wow. I apologize for this.
Most of this was the same.
Okay.
This was broken up a little bit, but it was the same information.
Yeah. All right. Well, here's what I'm going to do. So I'm trying to figure this out, and I don't want to put you guys at a disadvantage. I didn't realize that these were wrong because I have been doing this for a number of years using the same one. It's never been brought up to me, so maybe, I don't know. But I will not be. I will go through and see where there's the inconsistencies. And if there are inconsistencies, a lot of this stuff back on this in Article 11 and everything else, I don't test on anyway. But I will make sure. So where there's 9.7, if there's inconsistencies, I will make sure there's not questions on the exam about that. I don't want you guys to be like, oh, he didn't see me and he told me something else. So that. Thank you for pointing that out. So 9.7, and then I got to look at Article 11. Has there been any else that you guys have seen throughout? I apologize for this. Okay. I will go back, but I will make sure you guys don't get tagged for those. I apologize. And if that happens, well, I'll go back and make sure that my A201 is correct, too. So, in any event, you will not be tested on that. There won't be any penalties. You don't have to worry about those, other than just to know that they're there. Lots of this stuff, honest to God, and it's not to minimize... these lectures, lots of the stuff you guys won't be involved in for a number of years in your career, but it's good to have this kind of as a basis. So, and you will be asked about it when you for your AREs. So, okay. So this would be a fee if you wanted to use the instruments of service. So is this here? The initial payment?
Yes.
Okay. So this is like initial payment, like a down payment, like anything. You know, we need seed money to start up. That's 11-10-1. 11-10-2, unless otherwise agreed, payments for service shall be made in monthly, just like normal. Like, this is all basic stuff. That's why I don't really test on it, because the business you guys are going to go work for, they're going to have their own models of how they do this. But the point is there's language in the contract to allow the owner and the architect to come to an understanding as to payment obligations and payment terms. So, owner shall not withhold amounts from the architect's compensation to impose a penalty or liquidated damages on the architect. This is a really good provision for you guys, this concept of 11-10-3, because on the contractor side, liquidated damages come in, and we'll talk about that when we get into the A201 and what the purpose is. You can have liquidated damages on architects, but it's very rare. And what happens here is the profit margins, realistically, that the architect makes versus the contractor, and the dollars that are at risk are much, they're skewed. Contractors have a lot more dollars at risk, and so the profit margins are much greater. The architect doesn't. And what you don't want to have happen but this can happen. Let's say that the wall that falls causes a $2 million damage. It's not like a $50,000 to fix the wall, because the wall falls and the ceiling collapses and blah, blah, blah. So it's a big dollar cost. If this provision wasn't in here, the owner could say, I'm withholding all of these damages I have, and I haven't even proved that it's your fault. This provision says you can't stop paying me and withhold those dollars tied to damage on the project. We have to wait till we go through the mediation, the arbitration, and litigation process. And at that point in time, then I have to write you a check. As opposed to the construction side, more often than not, the owner will withhold payment and say, I'm not paying you that $2 million until you fix it. So there's a leverage piece. This tries to keep the owner from asserting leverage in 11-10-3 against the architect. And this is one I would fight for to keep in. So, again, talk to your lawyer about whether this is fighting to die on the hill, but this is one I would strongly recommend is to keep in as much as you can. And Article 10, or 12, I mean, special services, this is just a big fill in the blank spot. So sometimes you guys are going to have your own provisions you want to add. They're going to be standard. It's just a big cut and paste. Sometimes the owner will have some that they put in. Sometimes they'll negotiate it. So in the provision, in the architect's, in the AAA contract, it's just blank. See other. And then 13... just is more about, this is the entire agreement, this is the legalese part. Everything that's said in here is what's said in here. We can't deal with outside stuff. You may be using the B101, the E201, those types of documents that were mentioned in the agreement. And that is it. Any questions? Back there, and then your room. Okay, do you have one here?
Yeah, but I think it's kind of an easy one. But like, you mentioned with like having cost customers who sort of like after the fact and kind of like regretted proceeding with termination.
Yes.
What is the point of no return with termination? Is it like filing in court or arbitration, or is it like I guess?
So, it's a really good question. When's the point of no return and termination? When you first started talking about it, I thought you meant like, is there a time like in the course of the project when you shouldn't terminate ever? And like where the owner sometimes, where most of my owners want to terminate are when we're at substantial completion and we're at punch lists. And I'm like, we are at the finish line. Just work through it. But sometimes it happens much earlier when things are really bad. What will happen is all of your suspension and termination provision in this document and in the A201 that deal with owner-contractor all will include at a minimum a 7 days written notice provision. So you have to write a letter from the owner to the architect that says, pursuant to Article 9.5, I'm terminating you for convenience 7 days upon your receipt of this letter. the architect should call them up right away and say, I promise I won't ever wear that tie ever again, or whatever we can do to try to resolve it. Can we sit down and figure this out? What's the reason? What's this? What's that? And hopefully you have a business discussion about that. Sometimes it'll be this letter's provision is being written in 7 days, written notice pursuant to 9-4, because you have materially breached the agreement, and that's going to be a harder conversation with the owner than I promise not to wear the same tie to the site. Because they're already mad at you, and they've already, you've something that has gone wrong. What you hope is that long before the owner even contemplates sending that 9-4, that there has been something to address the problems with them. And that's where sometimes it gets strung out. I mean, like, the one client that I had that terminated, contractors said they were substantially complete, the architect did not, and the owner did not. There was still $1.5 million, $2 million worth of work to be performed. It wasn't just minor punch lists and everything else. And I sat down with the board and said, you do not want to terminate, because as soon as we terminate, you're going to have 25 mechanical lien actions against you, because you're mad at the contractor, and there's three or four of the subcontractors that have done a bad job. The electrician was one, the plumber was one, I'm trying to remember, there was an iron company, Specialty Ironwork. There's three or four of them that were bad apples, so to speak. The GC was really bad. They were playing with numbers and everything else. But I said, there are a lot of contractors on this project site that did a good job, but they haven't been paid because of the games that your GC's playing. And as soon as we terminate them, send this letter, every single one of them is going to file mechanics lien on your property, and then we're going to have 25 lawsuits in state court. And I staved them off for about 8 months, and we kept having negotiations, and we were trying to get, we had I don't know how many meetings, and I brought in experts to cull through the financial records and everything else. And finally the board was like, do it. And I'm like, don't. And they said, do it, and I did it because they're my client. And within 3 weeks we had 27 lawsuits. And it took another 2 years to resolve everything. It was great for my firm, but nobody made any money other than me or my firm. It was ridiculous. But so once you send that letter, depending on it, whether it's convenience or cause and whether the relationship is, you can always try to get it back. I mean, we even after we sent that notice of termination, the general contractor kept saying, we'll do this, we'll do this, we'll fix this, we'll fix this. We gave them a couple of bites at the apple. They still didn't perform because there was other problems, and the board just kept saying, nope, nope, nope. So it's business, there's a whole bunch of things that come into it. But I've been in termination issues less than a half a dozen times in my 35 years, because it's just bad. What was your question back there? First of all, did I answer your question? Okay, good. What's your question back there?
I was going to talk
about the return. Sure. I mean, I was going to do that. We're at time, so if you guys want to, I'm happy to talk. You know me, I like to talk all the time, but I'm happy to talk about it because we have one more class, but next week I'm going to do that class a lot shorter and have some more time, but I can talk about it now if you want. Yeah, I mean, if anybody wants to listen about the midterm now, great. But if not, I promise we will spend time next week talking about it. And I will have a couple of sample questions on the slide so you can see what they feel like and everything else. Is that good? Okay.